This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation. Welcome back to Blockbuster Rewind, our monthly series here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. I am Andy Atherton, one of your co-hosts. This month, it's my pick, so I am back in my chair. Thank you, Scott and Eric, for keeping it warm for the last 2 months. It'll go back around though, to those guys in the next couple of episodes. Lots of fun, though. Great jobs by both guys doing their first hosting duties. I'm very happy, very proud to be their co-host. But let's get them in here and get the show underway. First up, Scott Shiflett. What's going on, Scott?
Hey, Andy. Doing great. Love to be back talking about movies. It's one of my favorite things, and this series that we're going to talk about is one of my favorites.
Yes, yes. Goes back. It's been a long time since I watched all these all the way through, and I'm really, you know, glad that we decided to. It was my pick, but everybody went along with it, and I'm very happy that I got to revisit these. And also, all available on Netflix, you know, till the end of the year, I think, when they go to Disney Plus, I think. So
that is correct.
Very cool. Yeah. Also, our other co-host, Eric Eels. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing good, Andy. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to be back here and enjoying a new series to me.
Yes.
I'm 36 years old, and I finally started watching Indiana Jones this past week.
That's great. Well, it'll be great to hear your thoughts as we go through as somebody, as a newbie. So joining us, our guest for this month, you have heard him on Pop Goes the Classics with Scott Criscolo on both the James Bond series as well as the Star Trek series, Mr. Rob Piontek, otherwise known as Tech for short. Tech, how are you? Thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, doing well. Thank you very, very much for having me. I really appreciate it. Happy to be here.
That's great. Yes, I reached out to your co-host, your compadre, Mr. Criscolo, on those shows, and I ask, you know, knowing you a little bit from working in the same building, if you were a big Raiders fan, and you got the ringing endorsement, which is why we brought you on, and we're very glad that you can be here tonight and get your voice out there a little more on some more shows here on Place of Nation, but, as we like to say. So we are talking about the Indiana Jones franchise, as we have alluded to. That includes Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of the Doom, Last Crusade, and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Most of them came out in the 80s. One came out in the 2000s. And we'll break down each movie and kind of talk about our thoughts on each as we go through coverage of each one. Plot, you know, bad guys, action scenes, you know, locales. There's so much going on in these movies. And for the most part, it's all great. So my love of these movies started, I was a kid when these came out. You know, this first one came out in 1981. I was about 8 or 9 years old when I first saw this. I saw this in the movie theater, and I love this franchise so much. It is a throwback. You know, my dad loved this because it's a lot like the adventure films of like the 30s and 40s where it takes place, and it's so much. So let's kind of just go around though, and I want to get your guys' thoughts on the franchise in general, like, you know, how you feeling when you first was exposed to the movies, you know, not just Raiders. We could talk about the other ones as we go, but Tech, let's start with you since you're our guest. What are your general thoughts and feelings on the Indiana Jones franchise?
Well, I absolutely love them. I'm just a fan of action adventure in general. I often joke that if you look at my movie shelf, a good chunk of them either start with Star or end with Man. So, you know, All the kinds of, you know, science fiction and adventure and action and superhero stuff I'm just always been a fan of. And Indy, you know, slides right in there. And even off of that, I'm a big fan of pulp heroes and the smattering of movies that have come out about those. Not a lot of them have been great. You know, I tend to cite like The Shadow and The Phantom, you know, none of which really get a lot of love. But I have a soft spot. And this one, you know, is of that genre. You know, Lucas and Spielberg wanted to make sort of a Saturday morning serial action adventure, much like how Lucas, you know, approached Star Wars. But yeah, I've always been a fan. And I actually, I saw Last Crusade first. So that was my introduction. Nothing like jumping in on act three.
All right. Very good. Scott, what's your kind of feelings overall and general history with Indiana Jones?
I love the series. Like Tech was saying, it's a nice little throwback. It's just so much fun. Like you watch these movies and like I just get like so enthralled and sucked into like everything with them. And I saw them for the first time with my grandmother. She had all three of the movies on VHS. And I remember just wearing the VHS out. And I was so lucky to be able to go see one in theater when I saw Crystal Skull in theater, which when we get to it, I have some thoughts, but it's just great. And I will say one thing I do love about the movies is during the movies, he talks about other adventures he has. So it shows that these like just four adventures that we've seen, that's just like part of it. And it's just one of the things I love so much. It's like, he's like talking about something like, oh, what is that? And like, no one else knows, but like, you know, it happened. I just love it. Harrison Ford's the man. Like,
yeah.
From Star Wars to Indiana Jones. I love Air Force One as well. But he's just great. Just great. And he had the Jack Ryan movies. So, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, can you name, and there's not a lot of actors that have the 1-2 punch of being Han Solo and Indiana Jones in terms of the great characters that they've played. And really glad, you know, as great as Tom Selleck is, glad that, you know, he couldn't get out of his Magnum PI contract to play Indiana Jones, which is kind of why Harrison Ford was chosen. Eric, now you have just seen these movies for the first time for this podcast. What are your thoughts on Indiana Jones, and how come it has kind of escaped you up to this point? Or alluded.
I guess alluded me because Weird Way is one of those films I didn't really discover on cable. Like the kind of stuff like I grew up watching, like definitely like cable movies and such. Not really of that first or seen in the theaters. I guess another thing is like you sort of get spoiled on it like early on. Like if like you hear about the plot, like you hear about, you know, the endings and such, and certainly. Watching the first film alone, I've seen so much stuff that has been parodied in pop culture. Besides The Simpsons, and definitely Simpsons definitely a big one. I guess my whole thing is, if I already kind of know what the story is, I'm not as inclined to want to see it. I guess that's just sort of how my brain is wired in some ways. But I was definitely glad I'm more intrigued now and older, going back and watching older movies like the era of pre-CG. It's just sort of a comparison like with our last episode of The Matrix. So I'm like, there's a lot of really good stuff that came out of CG, very good action films, but I'm certainly very impressed by these films and their level of scope and production and just practical effects. And just from the first film alone, I sat there, I was taking on the ride. I very much enjoyed it. I enjoyed pretty much all these films for various reasons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get what you're saying though. If there's a movie that, you know, it's on your shame list, so to speak, as some people say, that, you know a lot, and it's like, really, am I going to be, you know, it's spoiled, whatever. Like for me, like I have not watched any of the Aliens films, but I kind of know things that have happened and characters, I guess, that have met their demise and all that stuff. So you kind of like wait for it. But I think, you know, a good movie, a great movie like that you may have had spoiled will suck you in. And yet that part may leak out of your brain while you're watching it. You kind of may forget, you know, what happens to these characters, like, because you just get so caught up in what's going on in the movie. Indiana Jones, we're starting with the first one. This is Raiders of the Lost Ark, came out in 1981, starring Harrison Ford as Dr. Henry Jones, aka Indiana, Karen Allen as Marion Ravenwood, Paul Freeman as Renee Belloc, Ronald Lacey as Major Arnold Taut, John Rhys Davies as Salah, and Denholm Elliott as Dr. Marcus Brody. So the plot is, in 1936, American archaeologist Indiana Jones overcomes an ancient booby-trapped temple in Peru to retrieve a golden idol. Though betrayed by his guys and cornered by rival archaeologist Balak and the indigenous tribe, he escapes in a waiting seaplane. Balak then steals the idol for himself. After returning to America, Jones is approached by two Army intelligence agents. They reveal Nazis are excavating Tanis, and one of their telegrams mentions Jones' old mentor, Abner Ravenwood. Jones deduces that the Nazis are searching for the Ark of the Covenant, which Adolf Hitler believes will make their army invincible, and the agents recruit Jones to recover the Ark first. So, this movie starts off with that great scene in Peru, in the jungle, which Indy's face is the last one we see in the opening until we get revealed after the whip of the gun. And we have a very early Alfred Molina. He has no fear of spiders. A crap ton of fear, though, by Alfred Molina's character. And the iconic scene of getting the idol and the chase by the boulder. So, Tech, we'll go back to you again. What do you think of this character introduction? How much is, like, really we know about this character already? And we don't see his face for a bit. And we kind of see how he approaches all the booby traps, how he gets through, and that iconic scene of him putting the bag of sand and subsequently stealing the idol and getting chased by the boulder. What did you think of this opening scene?
It really grabs you because, yeah, there's several minutes of nothing but shots and music. There's no dialogue. Alfred Molina has the first line, for crying out loud. But when Jones turns around, like you said, you see his face, he kind of steps out of the shadows. And the way it's shot, and even the way Williams scores it, you kind of get the impression this guy might be the villain of this story. Yes. Because it's very ominous, you know, like bum 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 as he steps into the light. You know, this isn't a clean shaven, you know, white hat wearing hero. He's grizzled. He's got the, you know, the brown fedora. And so you don't know what to think. You know, I wish I could go back. Like I said, I saw the third one first. So I was well aware of who everybody was, you know, so I go into this movie being, you know, fully well aware of what's going on. So I'm almost jealous of someone watching it for the first time, kind of in a vacuum, if you will. But, after that, you know, like you said, the scene in the temple, it's just become so iconic, you know, how it's shot, the moment where he's in front of the idol, you know, he's lit by that gold light. Mm-hmm. And then it's, of course, followed by the, you know, that giant spherical boulder chasing him, which, as we mentioned before, has just been parodied and homaged countless times since. But you get the feeling like who is this guy? You know, is he just like an adventurer? Is he some sort of just, you know, grave robber? And it's not until the entire prologue ends, you're like, this guy is a professor? What? Yeah. He's, you know, one could argue as we go along, we could make the joke that, you know, he's the world's worst archaeologist, because no matter what kind of stuff he comes across, he just ends up leaving chaos and destruction in his wake.
Yes. You know, as the scene continues, he, you know, is chased by the indigenous people, and he makes his way to the seaplane where the guys, you know, pilot's fishing, and they take off, and we learn Indy's fear of snakes we really don't know it's a fear, but he's just like, snakes, I hate snakes. You know, another iconic line. And the whole, you know, a little before that, it's like, throw me the whip, throw me the idol, I'll throw you up. All right. Yeah. And he, adios, senor. And, you know, we see what happens to him. Scott, what do you think of this whole opening sequence up until he gets into the plane and makes his escape?
It was great. It really sets the tone for everything. You see how much of a badass, like, Indy is. And, like, I know, like, he, like, gets it stolen from him at the end. But, like, you're supposed to see, like, he does all the hard work. And then the guy's like, oh, I just paid him off pretty much, you know. Because he has, like, Alfred Molina's character turns against him. But there was the other guy that tried to turn against him, too. And he cracks the whip with him and takes the gun from him. And the score is just amazing through all four of these movies. I know it was John Williams in the first three. I don't know if it was John Williams in the fourth, but he just crushes it. Like, everyone knows that tune. Like, once you hear it, you're like, oh, Indiana Jones, let's go. It just sets the tone. It's just amazing. Like, he's one of the greatest characters probably ever created in cinema, mm-hmm. to me. So, like, I'm just going to gush over him. I'm yeah. sorry in advance.
Yeah, the natives have stormtrooper aim in this scene as well. Eric, now you pop this in, you turn it on for the first time. What do you think of this whole sequence? Basically, our introduction to Indy as a character.
Well, I thought it was utterly fantastic. I was generally surprised because I've obviously seen clips of the idol switching in the boulder. There's a whole sequence at the ride at Disney World, which is portrayed in episode Step by Step. And I would just assume that this was towards the end of the movie. Well, it's like a big part of like the third act. It's him getting this idol. So to see it, this is his first adventure 10 minutes in. It was really something. Also, Chance, I was unsure of the history of this movie and with most early Spielberg films, why he was sort of the catalyst for creating PG-13, because this certainly is a very violent movie. And certainly with that, Alfred Molina portraying him, and then he is just impaled with spikes as Indy escapes. Like, that's a very gruesome image. That's a great, great mannequin for the sequence, but it's really something else, all leading into him escaping, and then the reveal of the knaves have him cornered, and the introduction of Balak. Balak, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Balak, yeah.
Balak. Yeah. Who's just a wonderful villain, right off the bat.
He basically is Indy's rival, and does, you know, doesn't do the hard work, basically, you know, tries to go the easy way. You know, Indy seems to be part of it is for the love of the, you know, the culture and stuff like that, and for the sense of adventure, I guess. Balak's just in it for the fame, fortune, and notoriety, what have you. So then Jones, he travels to Nepal to recover the headpiece of the Staff of Ra, a medallion that will be used to locate the Ark from Ravenwood. He then learns Ravenwood is actually dead, and the headpiece is now in possession of his daughter Marion, to whom Jones once had an illicit affair with. The sadistic Gestapo agent 8 Arnold Tott arrives at Marion's bar, flanked by mercenaries. A gunfight erupts, and the bar is set ablaze. Tott then attempts to recover the headpiece from the flames, but it only burns its image into his hand. Jones and Marion then take the headpiece and escape together. They travel to Cairo, Egypt, where they meet Jones's friend Salah. He reveals that Balak is assisting the Nazis, and they have a fashionary replica headpiece from the burns on Tot's hands. Nazi soldiers and mercenaries attack Jones and Marion. Marion is seemingly killed. Despondent, Jones confronts Balak at a bar before regrouping with Salah. And Inman deciphers the headpiece for Jones. One side bears a warning not to disturb the Ark. The other, the correct measurements for the Staff of Ra. Jones and Salah realize Nazis are digging in the wrong location. So, Scott, the introduction of Marion Ravenwood, who you know, is not her only time that we will see her in this series. What did you think of this whole bar scene, and how creepy is Arnold Tott?
Oh, I'm gonna start off. They make the Nazis seem, as they should be, creepy.
Yes.
And just horrible people. You see the guy burns his hand, like they're all like just terrible people. They burn down her bar. Marion's bar, you see, and I just love what I mentioned before with like Indiana Jones. You saw that like they have a history together, because she's already yelling at him and everything, and Indy's like, I'll just come back in the morning when you're calmed down. But it's just great. Like it does great character building there. And then when you think that she's dead, you're like, oh my goodness. And Indy seems heartbroken with that, which when I was watching the movie, I was like, how do they do that? Because I thought it was the same truck, you know. So I thought that was that was a really good freak out, because I knew what had happened in the what we see in the future movies, but I was like, wait, how did I because I'd forgotten about that. I hadn't watched the movies fully in years, so it was nice to see.
Yeah, I love the 1936 airplane travel, and I even though they parodied this in the latest Muppet movies, I love traveling by map. I just love it, because it's just, it reminds you of something they would do back in like films in the 40s and 50s. And they keep consistent throughout all the movies. Eric, what'd you think of Marion Ravenwood when we meet her and her toughness, basically drinking this guy under the bar?
Yes, definitely. I the first kind of glance a couple times, like, yeah, that's a dude she's drinking against. It's first off, but yeah, she definitely proves toughness. And then I was like, oh, she's also the bar owner. Okay, that makes sense. I was worried, like, if she's very tough, or she's very good about warring stuff down, or she's built a very good tolerance. So, there's a lot of crackling chemistry between Karen Allen and Harrison Ford right away. At this point, I would have thought that maybe her father would be more of a character. It was just sort of a one-off line about him dying. I thought maybe that might lean to something. He might actually come back. Turns out it's not the case. I was wrong. But this sequence is also very remind me a lot of like watching the Batman cartoons, where Batman just causes unintentional chaos and destruction everywhere. That's what Indy also does. It was just starting a fire and just burning her whole business down, and all of her money's gone. But she just sort of rolls with it. I'm like, okay, now we're partners and we're going to get to the end of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, yeah.
No, keep going.
Oh, yeah. And then we get to Cairo. And I really enjoy all the stuff in Cairo. I don't know if they filmed on location there. They obviously filmed in a bunch of different areas around the world, which I think it really adds to this movie, like so many great locales. They were to Tusca, I think that's it. Yeah, it's just great stuff.
Yeah, that's one thing I love about these movies too, is that they take place in so many different locales. I mean, if I'm going to wager a guess, and Tech will probably know this, they probably shot a lot of this in Tunisia, because that's where they shot a lot of Star Wars, so I think they probably had a good name there.
That's what it is.
Yeah. So we meet Salah. So Tech, talk about Salah. What do you think of him as a character, as well as the events leading up the introduction of Marion and Talk and all that, and as they travel from Nepal to Cairo.
Absolutely. But to answer your question first, they absolutely did shoot in Tunisia. As a matter of fact, the scene at the end of the movie where they're walking the Ark with that procession through the canyon is the exact same canyon where R2-D2 gets assaulted by Jawas. So there you go.
Awesome.
But we're starting to meet our ancillary characters. Well, not ancillary, our supporting characters. I admittedly had a major crush on Karen Allen in my youth. Not to say I still don't, but I've always loved Marion, and she is easily and quickly established as, you know, someone who's clearly capable, someone who can go toe to toe with this adventurer we've just been introduced to. And it's also structured very well. You know, a scene like this would not be told this way, you know, in the very explain everything, you know, way scripts are written nowadays. You know, all you get is the name. Oh, you studied under Abner Ravenwood in the previous scene. And then you learn, oh, this is his mentor. You know, it's a character you never even see. And you're introduced to his daughter. You know, you learn that, yeah, she was young. She fell in love with him. He kind of did something with her he shouldn't have. And you get all this stuff just from context. You don't get flashbacks or anything. So it's told really well. And then Douglas Slocum, the DP, shoots the hell out of this scene, because there's the iconic moment of Jones, you know, walking in and there she is in the shot. And the rest of the shot is this shadow of Indiana Jones on the wall with the, you know, the iconic silhouette of his fedora. And then after that, when he walks out, you know, she says to him, see you tomorrow, Indiana Jones. And it's just Harrison Ford in shadow with just a single light through the lattice work on the door on his eyes. It's amazing. It's beautifully shot. Then you're introduced to, you know, the Nazis. And once again, John Williams does his job of cueing you into who the hell these guys are, because you get this, you know, major key music cue as soon as the door opens. And there's this trio of seedy looking guys. Ronald Lacey as Tot is just creepy.
Yes.
there's no other word, just his delivery, his look, that it's sniveling. That's really the word to describe him specifically. That whole bar fight, you know, it's fantastic. You know, it's there's no music because you don't need it. It's all just action and spectacle. And then we get to Cairo and you meet Salah, the great John Rhys-Davies. As you know, another friend of Indy's who you just kind of accept, like, oh, this is a guy he knows. This is a guy he's been on an adventure with before, you know. And to answer your question, Eric, they definitely did shoot this in Cairo. As a matter of fact, the story goes, there's that very beautiful establishing shot when they're out on Salah's terrace or roof, and it's just Marion looking out on Cairo. The production team had to go to every home and ask them to remove their television antennas from the roofs, because it was 1980 when they're shooting this, and they had to make you think it was 1936.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really awesome.
So,
that's why he's here on this episode.
I'm here to entertain and inform.
That's something you wouldn't see these days.
Hmm?
That's something you wouldn't see these days, because they would just, CGI it. So that's
absolutely
a nice
they paint that out digitally. You're absolutely right.
So it's a nice little tidbit.
Very interesting seeing the production budgets for all four of these movies as they go a little higher, and then certainly the fourth one by comparison, not even by inflation alone. Jeez.
Yeah. So yeah, we all, and I was never more happy to see a monkey bite it, because he was a bad monkey.
Yes. I was a little concerned by the introduction of that monkey. I was like, oh, I've seen way too many stuff with monkey sidekicks where they're kind of part of the plot. I'm like, okay. First it's like, oh, he's a spy monkey. Okay, I can get behind this, a spy monkey. And then the spy monkey accidentally kills himself.
Oh, yeah, the monkey handler, I guess, or owner, poisons him by mistake.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, so did we ever get a scene where he figures out the monkey is dead? Like, I was thinking, because he reacts like the Rancor, guy.
Well, they show the monkey on the ground, which is something they probably would never do today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, but we don't see the guy who was the handler of the monkey, right? Knowing the fact that his monkey is dead? We don't ever see
that. No, I didn't see that, sorry.
Yeah, I thought he would cry.
Think we see him again.
Yeah. All right. So then Jones and Salah infiltrate the Nazi dig site, and they use the headpiece to locate the Ark's resting place. In a snake-infested well of souls, they recover the Ark, a golden, intricately decorated chest. But Balak, Ta, and the Nazi officer, Colonel Dietrich, interrupt them. They seize the Ark and throw Marion, who had been held captive by Balak, into the well with Indy before sealing it. He then collapses a large statue into the wall, creating an opening to escape. At a nearby airstrip, Jones and Marion destroy the flying wing intended to transport the Ark to Berlin. The Nazis then load the Ark onto a truck and flee, but Jones catches up on horseback, hijacks the truck, and escapes. He arranges transport to the Ark to London aboard a tramp steamer. So there's a lot going on in this next few scenes with the whole discovery of the Ark. And, that's incredible, that little, model city, and then, all the snakes, which I read up a little bit of facts on this, that where a lot of them were rubber hoses cut because of they couldn't wrangle that many snakes, I guess, to behave. And then the incredible fight scene with the large, muscular Nazi gentleman that does not end well for that said gentleman. Eric, what do you think of the Well of Souls, and then moving on to the Ark coming out, and again Balak getting the upper hand on Indy?
Yeah, definitely. I'm very intrigued by their relationship in times in Iraq. Right after Indy believes Marion has died in the car wreck, and Balak confronts him at that little restaurant there, and he does make a very compelling point how they're kind of two sides of the same coin. Although he's just a little bit more shaded. I mean, Indy, for all of his stuff, talk about this should be a museum and all this stuff. Like, he is also trampling on several indigenous cultures and such, and should leave well enough alone with what he does. But he makes a very compelling argument, and Sterling was not intending Block's infatuation with Marion. Although I can understand why, but certainly that's his real turning point, where it's like, it's not just that he's a Nazi contributor. He believes he deserves her, that she should be his property. And that's like, well, now you're a real asshole.
Yes. And Salah shows how much how great he is here. And also, you mentioned Balak's basically macking on on Marion. And one thing, he carries around a collapsible hanger. I mean, really, what's going on there?
Have you ever seen anything like that before?
No. The guy needs to keep his Nazi garb in all nice and neat and pressed and all that. And an incredible fist fight scene. Tech, where do you rank this on great fist man-to-man fights in all movies, actually?
It's a good one. It's definitely up there. I mean, you've got the very formidable Pat Roach as the Nazi mechanic who was a wrestler, and rightfully so, you know, this big hulking guy who, incidentally, Indy would fight again in the next yes. movie. it's iconic. You know, it has a theme park attraction modeled after it at Disney. You know, the yes. Indiana Jones Stunt Spectacular is comprised of three scenes, the opening, the Cairo marketplace, and this, you know, the giant, you know, flying wing Nazi airplane and, you know, just an all out brawl between Indy and this giant guy. And Indy's clearly getting his ass handed to him. And it's, you know, it's by sheer luck that this guy gets taken out by the propeller just through, you know, the dumb luck of where he is and Marion screwing up the controls and making the plane spin and all that. It's wonderful. And again, there's no dialogue where apart from, you know, Indy and Marion maybe shouting each other's names here and there. So it's all John Williams just scoring the action. And if it's one thing he loves to do, it's specifically that, you know, you'll hear music hits with punches, with kicks, you know, and that's one thing that he's done throughout his career. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was a little Star Wars-esque too with Marion in there in the gunner position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of reminds you, like, you know, she's in Luke's role in the cockpit, yeah. kind of there. So. Yeah,
and
ton of fun.
Here's your fun fact. The pilot who she beans with the chocks at the beginning of the scene is producer Frank Marshall. There you go.
There you go. It's great fun. Scott, what did you think of this whole this sequence between, you know, they get into the Well of Souls and they figure out, you know, that there where the right spot was, the Nazis were wrong. And then, you know, the fight with the guy by the dangerously close to the propellers, which does not end well.
Well, it shows how good of a, I wouldn't say paleontologist, but I know that's wrong.
Archaeologist,
yeah. I was like drawing a blank. It shows how good of an archaeologist that Indy is, that he's able to figure it out because, like, they literally have, like, a team of Nazis and the local people, like, hunting for this, and him and Salah are able to figure it out, you know, in basically a night and get it done. And like, you know, and then we have a flashback basically to the beginning where, like, Indy does all the hard work and, you know, that asshole's there to, like, reap the rewards. And as for the fight scene, I enjoyed it. And I know with it being PG, because they didn't have PG-13 at the time, I love the way they do, like, the brutal kills with this. It shows Indy and Miriam both looking away, which is something you'll see in the next two movies as well. I don't think you see it in the fourth movie, but it's a nice little added thing where they're like, someone gets decapitated and they just, like, look away, or someone gets steamrolled and they just look away. So I enjoyed it. The fight scene was great. It was like Tech was saying, with just the score there, it's just brilliant. You don't really need any lines, you know, but it's just great. I love it.
Yeah. So then I thought, you know, the chase scene was fun. I love Indy's line, basically, I'm making it up as I go along, which is said often in these movies, you know, because he just flies by a seat of his pants half the time, and, you know, just ends up on top by either, you know, skill or just dumb luck, you know.
Yeah.
So then bringing a gun
to a knife fight, which I very much enjoyed that sequence.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. That was the one with the guy with the sword. Was that here?
And he yes.
Takes out, yeah, that's a very iconic scene where the guy comes
with a sword. Apparently, there's supposed to be an actual, like, scene with them battling swords, and they just had to cut it for time, and it's great that they did.
Yeah, sometimes things work out when you don't, you know, when you have to, you know, work around things. He just, yeah, reaches in, shoots him, and walks away, which is callback in the next film. So, the following day, a Nazi U-boat intercepts the ship and seizes the Ark and Marion. He then, Jones covertly boards the U-boat. The vessel travels to an island in the Aegean Sea, where Balak intends to test the power of the Ark before presenting it to Hitler. En route, Jones ambushes the Nazis and with a rocket launcher, but is forced to surrender after Balak deduces that he would never destroy something of historical significance and also wants to know if the Ark's power is real. They then take Jones and Marion to the test site and tie them to a post. So let's stop there. The whole time, you know, this U-boat, you know, with the pirates and all that stuff. It turns out Katanga, I don't know if you guys recognize him. He plays, he's a boat captain. He also ends up playing Kingsley Shackle Point, right? Shacklebolt, yeah, in the Harry Potter films. And it turns out the German U-boat are the real pirates. And, you know, the U-boat never dives under the water, which I thought was a little funny. But so, Tech, what do you think of this whole sequence when we're moving up to the ultimate end of the movie where the arc is opened? What do you think of the whole U-boat and then into that little that island?
Yeah, oh, like you said, the U-boat sequence has always kind of baffled viewers for years that, you know, he manages to stow aboard a submarine that conveniently doesn't go underwater since he can't get in. But, you know, it's neither here nor there. It's Indiana Jones for you. But, yeah, you get to this, you know, island in the middle of who knows where, you know, how did they even think they show it on the map, but there's no reference point. And, you know, it's really this point of mystery. It's like, where are we? Where are the Nazis going? There's a base here. You know, what are they planning to do? So, and of course, you know, you inject the humor because there's Indy, you know, successfully or attempting to infiltrate. And of course, he grabs the one Nazi soldier who's shorter than everybody else and he can't fit into his shirt. And, you know, but in Indiana Jones fashion, he clocks the next guy and grabs his outfit. But yeah, everything leading up to that, you know, on board the Ben 2 Wind, the ship there that they're aboard, is a nice little breather, you know, because we've had all this action. Like we said, we had the fist fight at the plane, we had the truck chase, which is just, you know, doesn't stop. So you have this moment where you can just take a breath, you know, let the audience breathe for a bit. You know, you have this wonderfully romantic that turns humorous moment between Indy and Marion, where he's gotten the hell beat out of him and she's ready to be all tender. And then he just falls asleep because he's just exhausted.
Yes, this is great stuff. Scott, what do you think of the whole U-boat and getting to this island?
The U-boat thing, a lot of people like to poke fun at that, but I remember either reading or watching something that there's a deleted scene that they had did a storyboard for with him sneaking on the U-boat. So that's how, like, I've always just went away with it. Because, like, he would obviously die, but it was nice. It just shows how Indy's in you. God, I can't talk tonight. Just shows how great he is. And then with the rocket launcher, you know, his bluff is called because he does, at the end of the day, he's an archaeologist and wants to see if the stuff is real that he's been hunting all of his life. So it's a nice little way of like, yeah, you may think he's like a RoboCop and can't be stopped, but there are ways to take Indiana Jones out.
Yeah, he does have his weaknesses, I guess, so to speak. Eric, how are you on this whole the U-boat and then getting to the island?
Yeah, it's not really something to think about too much. Like he just manages to quickly escape. He's very quick, and I guess he's just riding the periscope part. They're not completely diving until they get to the island.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's the only part. I was like, it's odd, but I'm not thinking too hard about it because I'm just along for the ride at this point. I'm like, I want to see how we're gonna get there. Like I know what this ending is. I'm like, how are we gonna get there?
Yeah, that's the issue, you know, with having known some things. You like, you know the beginning and the end, but the middle is the part that you know you're trying to figure out.
Yeah, so, it's a good bluff. What he calls his bluff, Belloc. It's like you're not going to blow us up. Like he's very correct. So, mm-hmm. But I did enjoy him try at least being intimidating with a rocket launcher.
Yes, and I actually did go to that stunt show 2 years ago. Down in I have not been on the ride in California yet, but yeah, the stunt show was a lot of fun, and it's outside, it's open air, but you know, so be prepared, have some to drink if you ever go see it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they get to the island, right? And then Belloc performs a ceremonial opening of the ark, but finds only sand inside. He then instructs Marion to close her eyes and not look at the ark. Spirits emerge from the ark, followed by flames and bolts of energy, which now I was a kid when I saw this, and this kind of terrified me a little bit. The bolts of energy, which end up killing Balak, Todd Dietrich, and all the Nazis. We have the famous face melting scene, as it's like to be referred to by people, before the Ark seals itself shut. Jones and Marion open their eyes to find the area cleared of bodies, and their bindings are removed. So this is, you know, the final, you know, action sequence of the film, and the villains, you know, basically, you know, tempt with mess with God and spirits, so to speak, and pay for it. Scott, face melting scene. How did that affect? Did that affect you at all? And what did you think of the ending?
It terrified me as a kid, especially like because you see all the blood being,
yes,
like wiped away, and like just my eyeballs like being sucked out. It terrified me. I do. The only thing I want to know is how Indy was able to figure out, like, you just turn your head away and close your eyes. Like, I mean, it just shows how smart he is. But I just want to know, like, hey, did you like read something? It's like, hey, we probably shouldn't mess with these things, but. It is pretty great seeing all the Nazis being killed. Always great to see that in movies. But I'm pretty sure I had nightmares from watching everyone die as a little kid. Just because, like you said, it's horrifying.
Yeah, I remember going to see this with, I think, my sister, who's 4 years older than me, and my cousin, who's 3 years older than me. And we're walking out, and they're all like talking, like, "What's your favorite part of the movie?" And I'm like, "I like the part, you know, where he's running from the boulder." And my cousin's like, "I like the face melting. That was cool." I was like, that was terrifying. Eric, what'd you think of that? Have you seen the face melting scene? Had you heard about it before you saw this?
I've definitely seen some of the more horrific stuff. Definitely the face melting scene. And I'm like, God, I get away with that. And it turns out you almost don't get away with it, as I was ringing up. Everyone talks about the face melting, but Balak's head literally explodes like a scanner. Kill. But it's superimposed over these flames, which I think is their workaround from not getting a full R. Mm-hmm. That's what at least when I read up. But yeah, it's just it's really incredible stuff. Yeah, it's an incredible sequence all around. You know, this is like the cutting edge of Lucasfilm technology. I mean, yeah, this is obviously a big thing that we already talked about. This is Spielberg and Lucas combining their forces, and like, it's just really wonderful stuff. I don't know how he figures out they should just close your eyes, but he does, and it works. And it's just great. And then presumably that's all the Nazis were killed. None of them stayed behind in the sub. So I was like, okay, free sub. That's how we're going to get out of here.
Yes. So, well, go ahead.
Yeah. So that's how they get back to land.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. As we learned throughout the series, though, that he, as he's well read, he knows all these legends, knows all these things, and you know, it kind of reminds me, you know, as later as you see like Dogma, like you can't hear, you know, the voice of God, you know, cover your ears in that movie. So you know, you kind of see probably that is, you know, you can't you can't hear. Yeah, you know, maybe Indy knows something like that because he studied cultures and religions and all that stuff to get to where he is in the academic part of his life.
That's a great point, Dogma. I didn't even think about that.
So, yeah, comparing Kevin Smith to Indiana Jones movie. Tech, what do you think of this, the face melting scene, when you watched it the first time?
Oh, it's always been, you know, a highlight of the movie.
Yeah.
Just to see, you know, a slew of Nazis get, you know, smitten by God, you know, they're lightning shot into their chests and faces. And then, yeah, the big three up top, you know, shriveling up, exploding and melting. And it's, you know, it hits you because, you know, the movie to this point hasn't been terribly, you know, gory, you know, aside from maybe, you know, Alfred Molina with a few spikes through his body and, you know, the spray of blood on the plane wing, you know, nothing too overt. And then all of a sudden you're just hit with this moment at the very end. But to answer the question, Andy, I do like your reasoning though about the whole Dogma comparison. The real answer is far less creative. Turns out that the scene where Indy and Sala meet with Imam, who translates the headpiece earlier in the movie, there's more to that scene. I don't know if it was scripted or shot and deleted, in that scene, he tells them, like, oh, you cannot gaze upon the Ark or whatever, something like that. But it was left out of the movie. And I think to greater effect, because like you said, you know, you can kind of interpret, you know, how Indy kind of sorted that out with, you know, a little bit more creativity. But yeah, great scene, great ending. And yeah, we just have to infer that, well, there's a sub base in this island. I guess that's how we're getting out of here.
Yeah. Not as, you know, as creative, I guess, as you know, Brody and, you know, Matt Hooper fixing a you know, a couple of barrels to a pipe to swim back to shore. So the movie's pretty much over. So they go back to Washington, D.C., where Jones and Marcus Brody receive a large payment from the United States government for securing the Ark. Despite Jones's insistence that they tell him what has happened to the Ark, the aliens offer only that it has been moved to an undisclosed location for study by, quote-unquote, top men. Elsewhere, the Ark is crated up and put into storage among countless other crates in a large warehouse. So that ends our movie. I noticed one thing I noticed in the end credits is that there was an associate to Mr. Spielberg by the name of Kathleen Kennedy. So it kind of shows her start to, you know, to where she is now running Lucasfilm. So let's kind of go around, though, and give our final thoughts on this first installment of the Indiana Jones. Scott, let's start with you. What are your final thoughts on Raiders of the Lost Ark?
It's just a classic. It's a movie I can watch over and over again. And out of all of these four movies, it's the one I've seen the most. It's one of the movies where if it's on TV, I can just sit down and watch any part of it. I don't care if it's 10 minutes left, the movie just started, we're halfway through. I just love it. It just brings me back and makes me feel like a kid again, just watching, you know, Indiana Jones, doing Indiana Jones type thing. Harrison Ford, it's a great start to the series. And even if we left it at one, it would have been an all-time classic. But luckily, we were graced with three other sequels. So it's I just love it.
All right. Eric, what are your final thoughts on Raiders?
Well, I definitely know it influenced the ending to the first episode of The X-Files, where they put that box in a big room full of other boxes and just mm-hmm. close the door. Yeah, definitely. It's really something. It's a real great thrill ride. Like it's a little over 2 hours, and and nothing feels wasted. Like everything connects. It's just a really fun story, and it goes to unexpected places. I didn't know how he was gonna get out of it, and as I saw, like, I'll see that's even the most natural conclusion once they open the Ark.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool.
Very well. I watched the second movie like right afterwards. So pumped it was.
Yeah. Tech, what are your final thoughts on Raiders?
Oh, like Scott said, it's just an absolute classic. You know, it from the moment it starts, it just grabs you, and you know, doesn't stop. Like I said, there's only maybe like one or two moments where you can catch your breath during this movie. But you know, everything is on point. Everybody's performance is great. You know, Spielberg kills it the way it's directed. Douglas Slocum shot the hell out of this movie. And what else can you say about John Williams? You know, this movie has some of the greatest music he's ever composed. The Ark theme is iconic. You know, I highly recommend the track, The Map Room Dawn, where, you know, he's at the model. It's just a fantastic piece of music. And yeah, it's an absolute iconic classic.
Yeah. All right. So then 3 years later, we get Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Now, I'm actually, you know, reading. I have notes in front of me. And now here's something, Tech. I just got my mind blown. You think this is the sequel, but this is actually a prequel to Raiders. It takes place a year earlier in the timeline, doesn't it?
Correct. Yeah. And the only indication you get of that is that after the opening credits, it just gives you the location and the year, just like the previous movie. And this one says 1935. So unless you're like really paying attention, you're like, oh, well, the last movie was 36. You're just going to gloss over that.
Yeah. which I got to tell you, in all the years I've, you know, the movie came out, do carry math, 36 years ago. I was 10 years old when I found this out. So I just got my mind blown. So fun stuff. So let's go around again, though, and I'll give our opening thoughts on Temple of Doom, because, you know, as a kid, this came out 3 years later. So I was about 11, 12 years old, and I was psyched to go back to Indiana Jones again. Scott, what are your thoughts on opening thoughts on Temple of Doom?
It starts off hot with, like, you know, 1935. Like, I'd always thought that it was like, I was like, wait, does that, you know, so it, like we said, it's a prequel, but also shows, like, you know, when Indy gets poisoned, they do a good job of showing that he is a normal man. Like, he doesn't have, like, he's not some, he can be, you know, double crossed, which we see happen multiple times. And, like, he drinks his own poison because, you know, he thought he got one over on the I guess it was supposed to be the Yakuza. Sorry, I couldn't get that out. But it just starts off hot. They have, like, a dance number to set the stage. And, like, you know, Indy has, like, his own little helper who's, like, a waiter there. And, like, he's like, oh, yeah, see, I didn't bring anyone alone. That guy is killed off. And then we meet Short Round, who, you know, was in the Goonies. It just starts off great. And, like, you know, you think it's going to be something, oh, we're going to be in Shanghai, but no, it pulls a fast one on you, and we're actually in India. So I like that a lot.
All right. Eric, so you went, jump right in, kept it going on. So what are your initial thoughts on Temple of Doom?
Well, I was very surprised that we started out with a big musical number. That was for certain. I was like, okay, to do these kind of big elaborate musical numbers in a Chinese club in the 30s, I guess so. But no, I honestly, like, I seem like, oh, we're walking into another, like, mini adventure, like the first movie, and it is, but it's more closely tied because we meet our new female lead through it. Certainly enjoy the train of diamond for the, I get what turns out to be ashes of a great Chinese leader, and then the poison and such, and then the escape itself is really something. How, like, India is, like, pretty much cornered, and then manages to figure his way out of it, including hiding behind a giant gong as gunfire goes by. That was really something, and conveniently jump out of a window, like, looks like a fourth story, that there's all these different cloths, break your fall. I'm never sure what they're called. I always see them movies like that. Yeah. So no, it's just a really fun sequence. It leads into the introduction of Short Round. Like, I don't know why. I, like, why does he have a young assistant? Like, whatever. Let's just go with it.
Yeah, I mean, well, you kind of have to suspend your disbelief in some of these movies. Tech, what are your opening thoughts on Temple of Doom?
Oh, this is definitely the one that I've seen the least. In my youth, I was kind of deterred from seeing it because it is a little more, I guess the word would be grotesque than the previous movie, as, you know, in later scenes and all of the banquet and the ritual and all that. But this opening, like we said, how they keep the theme going of we're seeing the end of a previous adventure. You know, it's like the cold open of a Bond movie. You know, this is something that may or may not have anything to do with the greater plot. But to that point, this is Indiana Jones at his most 007. Obviously, you know, he comes down the stairs in the club in the exact outfit that Connery is wearing in the opening of Goldfinger, you know, the white jacket with the red carnation. And, you know, Spielberg famously wanted to direct a Bond movie, and Lucas came to him and said, I've got this idea. Let's do this instead. So it's in the DNA. So it only makes sense to see it. But, yeah, the opening is great. Again, it doesn't stop. You know, you're wondering, you know, what the circumstances are of this deal. You know, you get minor context clues, you know, enough to figure it out. And then, yeah, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. One thing about Harrison Ford as an actor, his facial expressions are just top notch. Just, it goes from, you could see confidence and then goofiness and sheer, like, panic and fear. He just, he plays it so well. You can't see anybody else in this role. So let's kind of go through the cast though really quick. So we have Harrison Ford returning as Indiana Jones, Kate Capshaw as Willie Scott. They want her to be the complete opposite of Marion. So that's why she's a tall blonde. You have Amish Perel as Mola Ram, Roshan Seth as Chatterley, Philip Stone as Captain Philip Blumbert, and Jonathan Ki Kwan as Short Round as Scott mentioned he also played Data in The Goonies, which came out around the same time. So that was a total, you know, mark out moment for me as well, because I was like, oh, my God, I forgot which one I saw first. But I just marked out because I recognized him from the other movie. So let's kind of go through the plot, though. In 1935, Indiana Jones survives a murder attempt by Lao Che, a crime boss in Shanghai who was hired who had hired him to retrieve the remains of Emperor Narahachi. With his young Chinese sidekick, Short Round, and nightclub singer Willie Scott in tow, Indy flees Shanghai on a cargo aircraft. While the three of them are asleep, the pilots in the pay of Lao Che dump the fuel and parachute out, leaving the plane to crash over the Himalayas. The three narrowly escape, manage to escape by jumping out of the plane in an inflatable raft. They ride down the mountain slopes and fall into a raging river, eventually arriving at the village of Mayapur in northern India. The villagers beg them for help and ask them to retrieve the sacred stone, the Shiva Linga, stolen from their shrine, as well as the missing children from evil forces at the nearby Pankot Palace. Indy agrees to do so, hypothesizing that the stone is one of the five Sankara stones given to the gods to help humanity fight evil. Yeah, this was, like you guys have all said, incredible. It goes from, you know, a dance number and a nightclub to a fun escape, and we meet Short Round, and they get on the plane, and as the plane starts to leave, you see the name, you know, Lao Che, or I forgot what exactly says inside the plane. You know that, oh, Indy may have gotten away, but he could be, you know, it went from the frying pan to the fire, so to speak. So, Eric, we'll start with you. What did you think of this whole sequence on the plane and the ingenious decision to use the raft to escape?
Yeah, it was certainly very, very unique. I was like, I don't know how to fix that work. I guess you gotta get those, I can't remember their names now. It was just very, unique sequence. I thought it was a fun sequence escaping from the club. I mentioned the, kicking around the diamond and the antidote to the poison repeatedly over and over. As well as the gang, you notice in the gang on the plane, the guy is leading them there. That's Dan Aykroyd in cameo.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. But yeah, definitely opening the raft, miss falling, laying on the slopes, and just diving into the river. Just it's really something else.
Yeah,
and Mythbusters. That's what I was thinking of. Get the Mythbusters. Okay. Let's see him try that out. Sorry.
Yes. I mean, this is a fun sequence. You know, they get down there and they get to the village, and you know, we got some. You know, you have the Willie. You know, as not wearing appropriate footwear for you know, riding an elephant, and you have the you know, the giant bats, and the couple of great lines that we hear in this. That's why they call it the Jungle Sweetheart, and Short Rounds. You call him Dr. Jones. So Tech, we go from jumping in an airplane and we get into a village, and the real adventure begins. Talk about the sequence from, though, when they make this, you know, unbelievable, you know, kind of survival out of the jumping out of the plane to, you know, taking up the next task, which is heading on to Pankot Palace.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, it's like you said, it's very unique, and it shows Indy's kind of, you know, fly by the seat of your pants ingenuity. Like, all right, there's no parachutes on board. What do we got? Well, we got a raft. That's something, you know, and it rides like an airfoil the way down, and luckily it doesn't flip over. And then just, you know, from there goes into this toboggan scene down this snowy mountain. It just keeps going and going and going until we're in a river, you know. Now they have the appropriate means of transportation down a river. And yeah, it's this rapid fire, you know, quick sequence. And now we've arrived, you know, he identifies it as India, you know, and then the mystery really begins. You know, you get this hint of, you know, mysticism that is about to kickstart their journey. You know, he knows what's going on. You know, he knows what the stones look like. You know, he's read about them. This is another instance where he's like, oh, this I've read about this, but you know, it talks about magic, and you know, the stone here, you know, keeps the village prosperous and all this, but you know, whatever, I want it for its, you know, there's a diamond inside this stone. So the phrase that keeps getting repeated throughout the movie is fortune and glory, fortune and glory. So we kind of see Indy's gold lust, for lack of a better term, And the adventure is what kind of turns him into a believer.
Yeah, yeah. Scott, what are your thoughts on this turn of events here?
You know, like, we'll get to it with the fourth movie, but with people, I remember when the fourth movie came out, people were up in arms about the nuking of the fridge. This is just this crazy of a scene, which I have no problem with, because the movie before, we saw the voice of God take out a battalion of Nazis. So you have to suspend your disbelief with this stuff. So I was perfectly okay with it. It's a nice adventure sequence. I did like how Indy thinks he's got one over on Lau, but when they shut the plane door, it's like property of Lau on the plane, which, you know, was a nice little thing right there. And I like this being a prequel after, you know, thinking about it, hearing these guys talk and watching the movie the past couple of days, because if this was a prequel, like, Indy, like, doesn't really believe in the mysticism, like we said of this, but after seeing the arc, he's like, you know, he would believe automatically. But with not, this might be his first time dealing with, like, something that, you know, you have to believe in and not be able to touch or see. So it's nice. I like how the reason how they're able to get Willie to go with them is because she hears Diamond, and, you know, she's supposed to be like a material.
She's a gold digger.
Yeah, material girl, gold digger. And she's like, oh, Diamond. And she perks up at that. So she's like, come on, let's go. And I'm not sure if we'll talk about it, but I'm just going to bring it up now. I like when, you know, the elephant is just like making fun of her the whole time and like nuzzling on her neck. I can't talk tonight. And she thinks it's the elephant tusk, but it's a snake, and Indy freaks out. I just love that scene because, like, you know, she would have freaked out if she would actually what it was. She's like, I told you to get off me. And it was like this big ass snake that she throws across, you know, the forest. But yeah, it was just, I just like, it's a, like how you said, Andy, it's a nice way how you went from like having like a tomboy type character with Miriam, who's wanting to get her hands dirty, to then you see many times in this movie how Willie is just like a gold digger. Oh, I think I'm going to marry, you know, the shaman or whatever. You
the Maharaja.
The Maharaja. Yeah, the Maharaja. So it's, I like how they did that, and they show how Indy, you know, it's kind of a ladies' man with this as well. Basically, like how you said with Spielberg wanting to direct his own 007, he, instead of having Bond girls, he has Indiana Jones girls.
Yes, he does.
Can I ask a question? Was anyone, obviously you guys have probably watched this a few more times, obviously, than me. Was anyone wondering, like, why Willie is so roped into this, like, easily on? Like, is there impression that she thinks she's going to also get killed if she doesn't get on the plane in Shanghai by the crime boss? Like, Indy's just pretty much taking her for the ride. Like, she's really just an innocent victim in most of this.
Well, so, I think, she's guilt by association, and she happens to escape with Indy, and, you know, I guess she feels maybe she's safer with Indy than she isn't. Tech, maybe you could maybe shed some more light on it.
It's a valid question. she's just kind of jumps out the window with him. She's in the car, and she doesn't really have a lot of choice in the matter.
Well, there's a line that Lao She says when he's saying that he can get another girl. So he's basically done with her.
That's right.
And so she's like, well, I don't have anywhere else to go. And once they get on the plane, like, they're stuck together because she would have died if the plane had crashed. And she doesn't know her way around India. She, you know, so she has to basically be with Indy until the very end, or hopefully, you know, find a rich Maharaja to marry with, which when we find out who the Maharaja is, it's going to be a little bit.
Yes, she may be a gold digger, but she's not a grave cradle robber, apparently. So we get to Pankot Palace, where they are welcomed and they're allowed to stay for the night as guests and attending a lavish but revolting banquet hosted by the young Maharaja. The officials rebuff Indy's theory that the thuggy cult is responsible for their troubles. Later that night, Indy is then attacked by an assassin. After Indy kills him, he discovers a series of tunnels hidden behind a statue and sets out to explore them, overcoming a number of booby traps. So this is also one of the more memorable scenes, because there is the this incredible banquet with here's our menu that we're going to have tonight at Pankot Palace. We got snake stuffed with baby eels, I believe they are, or they're baby snakes. We have beetles that, you know, you eat and you suck out, like kind of like you're eating like a crab or something. Then we have Eyeball Soup, which I think I heard later it was Cow Eyes. And then we have Monkey Brains, which actually had a friend in college that wanted me to try Brains. He was from Turkey and wanted me to come visit him, and he wanted to take me to a brain shop. So we'll start with Eric. What did you think of the whole banquet scene with, you know, because I thought one thing that stood out to me was Captain, you know, Blumbert, his kind of relationship with the Indians based on the whole, you know, British thing. And, you know, Chatterley actually knows an awful lot about Indiana Jones's adventures in Madagascar and Honduras, et cetera. So what do you think of this whole setting up of, you know, folklore and the banquet itself?
I quite enjoyed it. You get a nice little bit of building tension between Indy and the representative. I didn't quite get his name. Is it Thao? Sorry. Yeah, in between that and the, like, little comedy segments with just Willie understandably freaking out of the whole course. That's why she's so grateful when Indy shows the player a room with just fruit. So you need something. No, I very much enjoyed it. The whole sequence, the whole Majra. It's a nice little bit of a... It's a nice breather from all the action we've had previously. So, yeah. It's good. Which then leads into Willie and Indy seducing each other, kind of, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a very fun, tense scene where, you know, it's basically a battle of chicken, so to speak, a test of wills, who's going to be the first one to cave and go to the other's room, which is a lot of fun, something we hadn't really seen yet. You know, she really loves that apple that she attacks. Tech, what do you think of the whole banquet and the tension, I guess, between the Indian royalty or magistrate and the British?
Yeah, there's so much going on in this scene. Like, you've got, you know, on one end literally of the table, you've got Short Round and Willie, and it's, you know, it's all played for laughs, you know, her reaction to stuff and, you know, the identifying these dishes. And I've heard, you know, referred to this scene saying that a lot of people at this banquet, they look like they're all wearing a disguise because they've all got like big fake black mustaches on. But yeah, and then down at the other end, yeah, you've got Indy and Blumbert and Chatterlal and the Maharaja actually giving you some exposition, you know, about a setup for what you're going to see. And of course, Indy's just like, oh yeah, it's stories, you know, to tell, you know, ward off, you know, colonists and or scare children or whatever. And but as you learn that Chatterlal is actually involved, so he's just kind of countering him with, you know, some deadpan reactions. But, you know, again, you inject the humor. You know, Indy has the whole line about like, oh, what did they threaten to cut off? Was it your hands, your head? No, it was my misunderstanding. Yeah, all that stuff. And then, yeah, I cannot, after watching this scene from this day forward, I cannot say the name of the dessert without, you know, the proper inflection. You have to say, chill the monkey brains.
Yeah, they quite enjoy it. The guy's, like, just sucking down the snakes or eels, whatever they are. I can't remember which one, the way they clean those beetles. I mean, it is quite the scene, especially as seeing it as a kid. You're just like, oh, my, because we, you know, we didn't have cable like we do now with, you know, Travel Channel and all this stuff and Bizarre Foods, where you see everything and anything basically get eaten, where you never saw that stuff before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't have that kind of, we didn't go, you know, there's ethnic food, then there's that ethnic food.
Yeah. And funny enough, like, again, to bring it back to the, there's always going to be a comparison between India and 007 2 years prior. No, in 1983, the movie Octopussy comes out, and there's Bond in India, and he's served for dinner by the villain a stuffed sheep's head, and it's very reminiscent of this scene.
Yes. Well, you know, so many comparisons between all of these. So, Scott, what are your thoughts on the banquet scene?
Like it was discussed earlier, it was a human chess match, basically, with Indy and the Prime Minister. I mean, not the Prime Minister, but the... like assistant prime minister, and you definitely sense that something else is going on. And then, like, you find out the Maharaja, as we discussed, was a little kid, and for the longest time I thought it was a little girl.
when I was younger.
Because of the high voice and the kind of the way the clothes are fitting and all that stuff.
Yeah, so when I was a kid watching, I thought it was a little girl. And also one thing that's noticed there is that the British are there doing a random inspection. And they are not happy that they are there. So this is during the time when the British was, ruling over India. The snake surprise, and they cut open the snake and the eels or the other snakes come out. It's just disgusting. the eyeballs in the soup was a funny gag. And, how I said that, Indiana Jones basically has his indie girls, like the Bond girls. Willie wants that indie D, and they do that thing like 5 minutes, you're going to come back over here, blah, blah, blah. And, then Indy's fighting the guy and they turn around when like he basically hangs the guy by the ceiling fan. You just see like the shadow of the guy being sucked up to the ceiling fan and them looking away. So how they've been doing that. And then, it was pretty gross with all these, like we saw in the first movie, there was a bunch of snakes, and this one, there's like a bunch of spiders and everything in these horrible places, which how the hell do these things stay alive down there? So that's just one thing that I have. But yeah, it was a fun scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting way to get into a secret passageway, basically feeling up a statue, and then step on fortune cookies. I love that line by Short Round. And when Willie comes in and, Short Round doesn't listen, doesn't stop where Indy stepped, got the traps triggered. And who walks into a secret compartment like that? It was kind of reminiscent of the trash compactor scene in the collapsing chamber with the spikes, but some of the effects don't hold up though. There's so much great practical effects. They do some green screen, some CG that you could see kind of the bleeding a little bit, and it doesn't really hold up, but I thought it was a lot of fun. So then the trio reaches an underground temple where the thuggies worship Kali with human sacrifice. They discover that the thuggies now possess three of the Sankara stones and have enslaved the children to search for the last two, hidden in the palace catacombs. As Indy tries to retrieve the stones, he, Willie, and Short Round are captured. The thuggy high priest, Mola Ron, forces Indy to drink a potion that puts him in a trance-like state in which he mindlessly serves the cult. Willie is prepared for sacrifice, where Shorty is put to work in the mines. Shorty then escapes and returns to the temple, where he brings Indy back to his senses. They then save Willie and retrieve the stones while freeing the children. Indy defeats the hulking overseer, who's then pulled into a rock crusher and killed. Shorty frees the Maharaja from the effects of the potion. So there's a lot going on. We set, as Tech had mentioned, with some of the violence, we see basically a beating heart pulled out of somebody's chest. And the guy goes in and basically gets engulfed in lava. And we go through the whole, the potion, and we see Indy, acting, without free will, and Shorty gets, enslaved. So Tech, let's talk about this whole sequence with, the whole pulling out the chest. What were your thoughts when you first saw this movie?
This again, as I said before, I was deterred from watching this movie at a young age, but somehow through, whether TV or whatever edited versions, I, saw it here and there and got the gist of what was going on. But yeah, it's freaking crazy. Like, it's like they took that last scene from Raiders and they said, let's ramp this up. We can lower this guy into a pit of fire. They can pull his heart out. The heart will burst into flame in the guy's hand. It's wild. It's absolutely wild. But yeah, there's a lot going on, especially when, they capture Indy and there's that hole. It's an awful, awful scene where, he's forced to drink this blood potion, whatever it is. And then he's just kind of left alone and he's writhing in pain and agony. And you're like, what is happening? Is it physiological? Is it mental? Is it mystical? And then, it comes down to, they put Willie through that same thing and Indy's essentially sided with the villain, against his will. And it comes down to Short Round. Short Round is like we said, enslaved with all these children who have been captured. He's the one who actually incites a prison break, essentially, and then saves Indy's life. It's a lot that happens, and it's just wild.
Yeah, yeah, and there's the whole whipping scene, plus then we get the voodoo doll coming in. Scott, what did you think of the whole thuggy worship and the human sacrifice part and Indy's unwillingly helping them?
Well, for a movie that in the first movie didn't really have that many dark moments, this like 20-minute sequence is about as dark as you can get in a movie. You have a guy with his heart being ripped out of his body by another person's hand. Then he's sacrificed when the heart just explodes a fire in the shaman's hand. And you see that the Maharaja is part of that as well. Then Indy tries to save the kids and gets overpowered. And not only is Indy whipped, but Short Round is whipped as well. And like you can see them just beating the hell out of it. And then Indy is basically turned into a zombie. And like, you know, they have a bunch of child slave workers. And it's just like, what the hell has happened in the last 20 minutes? We took a turn from like nice little action adventure movie to like, oh my goodness, what is going on? And then we see the only way to bring this back is Short Round basically has to burn Indy for him to wake up as they were about to sacrifice Willie. And that's a fun fight scene when they're Willie's dangling up there about to be burned alive. And, you know, Indy's taking on all these people and everything. So it was just crazy. And, yeah, you know, you weren't really expecting that's something that dark with the Indiana Jones movie going in. But there you go.
Yeah, and Charlie Lay, who's not to be much of a threat. I mean, I don't think this guy has any imposing physical traits. So, Eric, as a first-time viewer, what was this whole sequence, this 20-minute scene between the sacrifice and the heart getting pulled out of the chest? What were your thoughts on it?
Well, I was certainly familiar with the heart pulling out of the chest as parodied in episode of Clerks, which also involved tying in The Last Starfighter and Bad News Bears all within the same plot. Funny stuff. But yeah, this whole sequence is really great. There's the whole underground temple. It's just a wonderful set. And just everything from like the first sacrifice. Indy being put into the trance, being forced into a trance. I didn't expect that. That was a really cool sequence. Until it's pretty much just fire or some sort of extreme pain to sort of whip you out of it, as that works for him and the Majora. Just really great stuff. Great stuff all around.
Yeah, they're all both Indy and the Maharaja are under the black sleep. And the very use of the voodoo doll was pretty good in this. And then we get this incredible sequence. Eric, we'll stay with you on this minecart, Ryan, which you see, laws of physics, at times are questionable, suspension of disbelief. But where were you? I'm very curious. Like, we keep saying that this is your first time viewing. Were you on the edge of your seat though with this whole this minecart chase and ride here?
It was a pretty fun sequence. Like these two movies so far, I've seen, it's like these are very well put together action sequences or chase sequences for sure. I thought it was really cool. It's just, it really went on for a while, and it's the point of like, wow, they could easily flip over any point and just be crushed. Mm-hmm. Because they saw the other people chasing them. But I certainly enjoyed it. I think maybe it went on just a little bit too long, but then certainly surged into the next part, which is where they attempt to just drown them by flooding the compartments. Mm-hmm. And they have to escape out the side of a mountain when the water is gushing out, and then go from there. Mm-hmm. Like it is overall really, really fun.
Yeah. So Tech, where would you rank this in terms of action sequences or fun, chase scenes in the movie so far that we've seen?
Well, it's definitely a scene that a lot of people cite as, the one they recall. You say Temple of Doom, like, oh, the one with the minecart chase, so it's definitely a touch point for a lot of viewers. It was a sequence that was originally scripted for Raiders, and they just had no idea where to put it in. So they managed to fit it in this one. But yeah, like you said, it's just wacky, how it tips and rolls and tumbles and jumps and all this. And, there's cuts between, the actors and miniatures, and and while you can spot it from a mile away, a lot of times it's got that charm to it, like, oh, this is legit, or 1980s practical effects. This is just, it's up there with the truck chase from the previous movie, just being pursued by the bad guys, picking them off one at a time. And then they try to flood the tunnel, and It's a la, you know, Die Hard with a Vengeance, where he's going down the tunnel in the truck being chased by the water. And then, yeah, then we end up out on the cliff at the bridge.
Yeah. Scott, what are your thoughts on the mine train sequence?
I enjoyed it. I just felt it went like a little bit too long. I was like, how long is this thing going? But it was fun. You know, Indy used some nice ways of how to stop him by throwing, you know, the big ass board basically to slow down the other one. You know, all these people have shoot like stormtroopers. Like, Indy has not taken a shot, like a bullet at all. Like, I know he gets his ass whooped sometimes in hand-to-hand combat, but like, you know, no one's taking like a bullet in like the shoulder or anything. So, but I know it's PG at the time, but it was just, I just felt it went a little bit too long. I did like the very end when the water's like rushing out and they are basically standing on the side and you see the water just start shooting everywhere out of the mountain. It was a nice little sequence right there, but just a little too long. They could have just cut like a minute and a half off of it, maybe two.
Yeah, you have Indy, you know, stopping it with the breaking with his foot where he gets a hot foot. You know, and, you know, call back to Raiders we get here with once they get up there with the other guys, and he doesn't have a gun this time and he's got to take off and run. So then the trio escape the temple, pursued by the thuggies, and barely escape Mola Ron's attempt to flood them out. They are again ambushed by Mola Ron and his henchmen on a rope bridge above a crocodile infested river. Indy then cuts the bridge, leaving them to hang for their lives. As Mola Ram and Indy struggle, Indy invokes the name of Shiva, causing the stones to glow red hot and burn through Indy's satchel. The two stones fall out. Mola Ram tries to catch a third, but burns his hand and falls from the bridge. Indy catches the stone safely and climbs up just as the company of British Indian Army riflemen sent by the Maharaja arrive and open fire against the thuggies to drive them away. Indy, Willie, and Shorty return to Mayapur with the children and return the stone. So a lot, you know, happens here as well that I kind of went through kind of quickly, but the rope bridge sequence I think is incredible. I really kind of love, you know, Indy and Short Round kind of knowing each other a little bit, and Short Round kind of knows what to do. Hold on, lady, we're going for a ride. And Willie's just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. It is so much fun. And then we get crocodile feeding time, and you learn that nobody takes Indy's heart. And, you know, and as Mola drops, I think he's dead by the time the Crocs get him. You guys can give your opinion on that, you know. And then at the end, we have Indy bringing, you know, Willie close by with the whip. That's one way to, you know, bring a lady close to you. So a lot of stuff happened here, a lot to unpack. So let's starting with the rope bridge and then the ultimate end of Mola Ram. Tech, what do you think of this whole this sequence?
It's a great climax. You know, it's a lot of people cite the shot of him, you know, on the bridge with the machete, you know, is, you know, sleeveless. You know, that's one of the more iconic shots of Indiana Jones from this movie. But yeah, it's a cool face off. You know, he's kind of literally trapped, you know, in the middle. You know, the enemy is surrounding him, you know, and he's got one way out. You know, we're gonna cut this bridge and take our chances when it swings against the rock wall. But, and then, yeah, the final face off with the villain, which, you know, he really didn't have in the previous movie. You know, he's not the one who dispatches the bad guys at the end. You know, God literally takes care of that. So you actually get Indy to face off with your main villain here, Mola Ram. And it's the moment similar to the end of Raiders where he accepts what he's dealing with and he understands what this power is that he's dealing with. And, you know, he invokes, you know, Shiva, and, you know, burns the stones, and, you know, Mola Ram, like you said, it's not the fall that kills you. It's a sudden stop at the bottom.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, yeah, they get back to the village and they've restored the stone and everything's green and water's flowing and the children are back and, you know, cue the theme.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott, so what do you think of the whole rope bridge and the ultimate demise of Mola Ram?
Like Tech said, the bridge scene is just amazing. It's famous. Like, each of these movies have scenes that, you know, you can just say it, and everyone has seen it, or maybe even, like, as Eric said, in his case, he knew of certain scenes. This is one of these scenes. Like, you know, he's surrounded. It's like, oh, how's he going to get out of this one? And you see him, like, he tells Short Round to, like, hang on and like they dig their feet in, wrap their feet around like the rope. So when he cuts it, they don't all immediately fall to their death. It's a nice little thing of them like communicating right there. And then the battle with the guy who probably could be a wrestling heel, trying to take the heart. That would be a special move, would be him like doing like the heart punch or something. But he was basically doing like his own heart punch, and Indy's fighting him off. And you know, they're both dangling there. And I like how Tech said, you die when you when the ground stops you. But I love how they showed the gators there. The gators were just eating the people that were falling. They had like their own buffet going on. I thought it was a great ending. And just a great movie. And I love how like Indy sees like how the mysticism works with the stone being returned. Like you said, everything is green, because the first time we see the village, it looks like it was like a bombed out village. Like everything is brown and dreary. Mm-hmm. Everyone looks like, you know, they're about to die. Like they're asking them for help. And then you see it again. It's green. Water's flowing. The kids come back. Indy had saved them from the enslavement camp, which that was a great scene as well. It was just great. It was a great ending. It, you know, basically say goodbye to the girl, because that's the only time we're going to see her. She becomes Steven Spielberg's wife, spoiler alert. So, yeah, just great. I loved it.
Yeah. Eric, what are your thoughts on the ending of the film?
It's really quite the sequence of events. Wing, like, getting out of the bridge, cutting the bridge in half. Being shot at arrows and thankfully not getting hit. Everyone's got bad aim at that point. So the attempted chest bursting sequence, pulling out the heart. Thankfully, then he uses his own fist to punch him in the face.
Yeah.
It's a fun thing. And then, again, it's like Indy using the incantations to make the stones flame. So you can burn his hand, and then he just falls. That's a lot of fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Until the army finally arrives. So yes. Yeah, it's a great sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yep, great films. So kind of go around now. Final thoughts on Temple of the Doom and where it ranks, I guess, in terms of you know, in the series. Even though we haven't talked about two of the films, but kind of see you like it better. Is it above Raiders or you think it's a notch below? Scott, we'll start with you. What are your closing thoughts on Temple of Doom?
All right, I'm just going to do the first two. It's second for me right now behind Raiders, which, spoiler alert, Raiders is going to be my forever number one. It's just so good, but 2 through 4 will change. But as of right now, it's 2. It was a great sequel, quote-unquote prequel, to the first movie. It ties in together. You just want to see more adventures of Indiana Jones. You want to see where he goes next, or maybe what he did before. You just want to see more of it. And that's what the whole time I was like, we only got 4 movies. I could have done with like 10 of these things, just because I love like, you know, the archaeologist stuff. I love like the bedtime stories, as they're referred to, as that's a thing that's repeated a bunch in these movies, these bedtime stories that become true, because we all want to believe that, like, you know, there's, you know, like with the next movie, Last Crusade, there's these mystical stones. There's, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and everything. You just want to believe these things are real, and like aliens and everything. So it just adds on to that for me. I just love it. I'm sorry. I said one negative thing, is that the cart chase could have been a little bit, you know, shame all some time. But other than that, I loved it. I'm sorry. I just won't get a negative review.
All right. Eric, what are your closing thoughts on the movie?
It's a good fun time. I'm also in agree on that cart sequence, need some time off. It's good. If I'm gonna rank it as 3, because I missed some of the supporting characters from the first film, like Brody and so on. Why I'm happy they're back in Last Crusade. I would have liked to have seen Short Round involved. I thought he was a good addition. He's fun. Obviously, you know, I also enjoy the Goonies quite a bit. So, yeah, but it is a very good sequel. Very dark. It's certainly the darkest of all the 4 of these movies, just of its tone, everything. Mm-hmm. But good. Good. A good direction for the film. for the sequel prequel. I had fun.
Yeah. All right. And, you know, I'm surprised we never saw Short Round again. He didn't come back in a Last Crusade. But, Tech, what are your closing thoughts on Temple of Doom?
Yeah, to echo what Eric said, you know, it definitely has this dark tone that is in many ways, you know, contrasting the movie that comes before it and the one that comes after it. And to that point, this one is kind of an outlier in terms of the whole series. I know we're only halfway through, but if you look at the four as a whole, this one really just kind of stands on its own, A, because of the tone and the subject matter and how a lot of it's portrayed, and B, yeah, these characters. And in the other three, we see repeat characters, you know, not always, but here and there. And this one is just, you know, this is the only time we see Willie. It's the only time we see Short Round. But for me personally, this movie always kind of had this stigma attached to it. You know, again, told not to really watch it because it's violent and scary and whatever. And it wasn't until I was, I think, in college that I really sat down, watched it, and really gained an appreciation for it. I'm like, this movie is not like the however people described it, either it was bad or violent or just not good. And I'm like, no, this one's a lot of fun. It's a worthy entry into the Indiana Jones series. And, you know, hell, I know people, you know, you're always going to find something, whether it's a TV show or a movie series. Some movie is always going to be somebody's favorite. It's going to be somebody's least favorite. And while this isn't my favorite, I know a guy where I work, Andy, Jamie Nemchek. He cites this as his favorite Indiana Jones movie. I'm like, hey, you know what? If you love it, that's great. It's got redeeming qualities for many, many viewers. But yeah, of the series, if we're looking at the four, I put it third.
Okay. Yep. So for me, actually, going in, before I did this rewatch for the pod, Temple of Doom was actually my number one from memory. You know, like I said, it had been a long time. I've been trying to get my kids to watch it. And, you know, it's just, it's a different time now. You know, I think there are some parts of these movies that may move a little slow for my son. And my daughter is, 18 now and is more interested in watching SVU reruns all the time. Although she tries to watch The Mandalorian with me every week, which is great. On my rewatch, I'm actually going with Raiders as my number one. In terms of, I will rank the other two when we talk about it later. But yeah, I would say Temple is probably... I go back and forth on whether it's second or third, but definitely... lots of great sequences in this. I mean, you know, probably not the best movie, but probably has a lot of the best sequences from the franchise in it. So we're going to continue talking about this franchise. We're going to go on a last crusade and to visit a kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So we're going to talk about that in just a minute. We're going to take a short break. So with Scott Shiflett, Eric Eels, and our very special guest Tech, we are talking about the Indiana Jones franchise here on Blockbuster Rewind. Stick around. We'll be right back. PlayStation, welcome back to Blockbuster Rewind. We are talking about the Indiana Jones franchise. I am Andy Anthony, along with my co-host Scott Shiflett and Eric Gills, and our guest Tech. We're breaking down the great franchise. We are going to we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark and Temple of Doom. We'll be getting to Last Crusade in just a moment. But first, let's talk about what's going on here on the PlayStation Pop Feed. Lots of great stuff always up on the site. Right now we have our, it will have concluded by the time you hear this, but every week we're covering each episode of The Mandalorian. We're doing a review. Pop Goes to the Couch. It is pretty much me, Scott, and Sean Kidd. We've been joined by Tim Capel a couple of times, as well as, we may have some bigger, some more guests on the season finale. Tech, have you been watching The Mandalorian this year?
Absolutely, every Friday.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on this season, just in general? Is it better than the first season? Is it just the same, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a little bit better than the first season. There's just moments that I've just been giddy when I see them, without giving anything away.
Well, yeah, because I think you're familiar with the whole. You've seen Clone Wars Rebels, right? You've seen.
Oh yes, I am. Yeah. I am a well educated Star Wars fan.
Yes, you know the canon, so to speak.
Yeah.
Eric, are you all up to date on Mandalorian? Did you see the whole season?
No, I am not up to date at this point. I haven't started season two yet.
Okay.
So that's what I gotta get on. Especially with 10 more shows that were just announced this past week.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we cover that on the season finale of Pop Goes to the Couch, the Mandalorian season two. Also, check out a couple of Pop Goes to Classics that have been up recently. That is myself, Miranda, and Steve Riddle. We talk about, we're going through the Disney animated features in chronological order. The last two episodes that have gone up are Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland. And coming soon, after you hear this, we have, we'll have, let me get my list up. We have Peter Pan and Lady and the Tramp. That is next on our list. So stay tuned. We try to do two of those a month, as well as Making Mount Rushmore comes up twice a month. On the latest episode was our Christmas episode. We did the Mount Rushmores of Christmas songs as well as Christmas specials. That was myself, Sean Kidd, Logan Croslin, and Ben Locke. Tremendous time on that. And stay tuned for the next episode of Making Mount Rushmore. Ben Locke actually is our moderator / host on that episode. So he did a tremendous job, and check it out. Lots of Christmas content though here. A piece of the action editor is our good friend Matt Souza, doing a tremendous job, doing live watches of action movies. We had a couple of Christmas episodes for him. He did Rocky IV, and that was, you were on that one, Scott, as well as Ben and Sean. Lots of fun that episode. And also he did an episode with Die Hard, where he had Sean again and Jennifer Smith and Ben Locke. So check those out. I've had a couple of Christmas episodes of Laughing Theater. That was National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. That was, again, Sean Kidd and Tim Slomka, who, I was very happy. First time I had done a pod with Tim, and it was a lot of fun. As well as, Scott, you were on my Home Alone episode with Logan, Ben, and Callum. The Scotsman stayed awake for us. We were very happy. It was a tremendous amount of fun, a great time. And also, don't forget to check out the latest episode of Great Debate with Sean, Scott, Souza, and Logan. That is the Christmas episode of that. Lots of great Christmas topics over on the wrestling feed, the Wrestling Network. Check out all the great shows that you hear, A Place to Be Podcast, Main Event, Chicken Salad, Highway to the Impact Zone, all kinds of great stuff. Don't forget, check out the North-South Connection. That is the Extreme Three-Way Dance, Shrink Wrapped, This Week in the NFL, all kinds of fun stuff. And also the Jenny Position with the Journey Through Infinity, Geek and Sassy, and tons of fun stuff. Don't forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each and every day. Articles, fresh takes. We have This Week in WWE by John Crow. We have Trent SmackDown Fox Report. Steve Riddle's Disney animated reviews. We have Matt Rotella with his live-action Disney movie reviews. All kinds of fun stuff. Paulie's Perspective. It's a ton of fun. Don't forget to check out the Place to Be Facebook group. Lots of fun going on there. We have articles, tournaments, polls, fun memes are posted there. It's just a great engagement and a great community. If you're not a member of that, make sure you are. And don't forget, coming soon in January, it is PTBN Trivia Night. It is going to be a game show pod. We have 9 themed episodes where you will be, if you are on one, you will be tasked to, compete in a, if you know that subject. The 9 episodes are Seinfeld, Harry Potter, Disney, Friends, Star Wars, the 80s, the 90s, Marvel, and classic movies. And if you win an episode, you will move on to the semifinals. There will be 3 semifinal matchups. Those 3 winners will move on to the championships, and then whoever wins that will be declared the first ever PTBN Trivia Night champion. And as your prize, you're going to get a championship belt, your very own belt with the logo of the show. So check that out in the Place to Be Facebook group, and all kinds of fun stuff is going to ensue. So with that being said, we're going to continue on with the Indiana Jones franchise, and we move on to 1989 with the third entry, and it is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. This is actually probably the one. Now, I can't not say I probably had not seen as much as the others, except for the last one, because that came out so much later. But I had some blind spots in my memory on Last Crusade before I watched it. So let's go around. Eric, we'll start with you. I guess you didn't go three in a row. You probably watched this a day or two later or whatever. What are your initial thoughts on Last Crusade?
I thought it was a really fun movie. I thought it was, I guess, not really back to basics, but like elements that we enjoyed of Raiders were back. Characters were back. We're fighting Nazis again. It's always fun to fight Nazis in these films. So, and just a lighter tone. It's a lot more comedic elements, but it really works, which once more, some wonderful action sequences, and Connor is certainly a great addition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tech, what are your opening thoughts on Last Crusade?
Well, as I stated earlier, this was the first one of the series that I saw when I was young. And spoiler alert, it's my favorite out of all of them. I have nothing but fond memories of this movie. It's easily the one I've seen the most. We go back to the well a bit. You know, the opening is the way the movie is structured early on is very reminiscent of Raiders. You have the whole prologue sequence, this time a flashback, and then you know, very similar structure after that. You know, Indy in the classroom, Marcus comes down the hall, and you know, it goes from there. It has everything going for it. You know, you've got a beautiful female lead in Allison Duty. You've got the introduction of Sean Connery. You know, Sala comes back. Marcus comes back in a much larger role, this time to more comedic effect, which a lot of people take umbrage with, but we can discuss that later maybe. Overall, it's absolutely fantastic. You know, like we said, we're dealing with the Nazis again. You know, we're once again going after a religious artifact of enormous significance, you know, which culminates in another fantastic climax amidst the canyons of Jordan. All in all, absolutely love this one.
Yeah, this is more of a truer sequel now that I know that, you know, Temple of Doom is actually a prequel in the timeline. It makes this movie makes a lot more sense to me now. Scott, what are your initial thoughts, opening thoughts on Last Crusade?
Outside of the most recent one, it's probably the one I've seen the least amount, just mm-hmm. because it always seems that Raiders is on TV, at least when I'm watching TV. I will say we can count this as talking about like the beginning part. It made it seem like if they were going to continue this series of movies, because I guess with it being Last Crusade, I guess was it announced ahead of time that this one was going to be the last one? Do you know that, Andy?
No, I mean, I think they were. I think there was going to become a fitting conclusion, I think, with this. I mean, they could have stopped there and nobody would have questioned it if, you know. Of course, you know, what's old is new. Everybody wants to see their favorites back again, because they had the TV show also, the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which I guess kind of scratched the itch for a while. But yeah, I mean, this in terms of the title, yeah, I think we thought this was going to be it for Indy until he comes back, you know, about 15 to 20 years later.
The reason why I ask that is because I could see River Phoenix, who was, you know, a child actor, I think he was in his early 20s when he was doing this. I can see him taking the young Indiana Jones role right here, because they give him, not to steal a wrestling term, they give him a lot of shine. The first 15 minutes is this flashback sequence of young Indiana Jones saying this has to be in a museum, what they find. And you notice that he's going against, you know, archaeologist that looks very similar and is wearing a bunch of similar things to what we see old Indiana Jones wear. And I could just see them doing, if they wanted to, they could do some of the stories that is alluded to in the movies with, you know, River Phoenix and the young Indiana Jones role. And I didn't even know they had made a TV show until mm-hmm. you mentioned it, Andy. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, they made a couple. There was the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which ran from, I believe it was 1992, 1993. And then there was The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones in 2002, 2008. And there were books and games, you know, made also. Tech, are you also, you know, we talked about your Star Wars fandom recently. Did you watch the, either of the Indiana Jones shows?
You know, I didn't. I was made aware of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles because there was a preview for it at the beginning of the VHS copy I had of Last Crusade, oddly enough. But at that time, I didn't look enough into it to find out when it was airing or where it was airing. And it wasn't until about 2000, I think it was 13 or 14, it was on Netflix. And I was like, oh, I can finally watch this show. I got two episodes in and they pulled it. And I haven't found it since. I can only assume that it will eventually show up on Disney Plus, much like these movies will make the move at some point. And when it happens, I plan on jumping in. But I mean, all I know is that it, you know, it covers his adventures when he was, you know, young, like 10 years old. There's the young actor played him there. And then there are other adventures where he's much older and he's played by Sean Patrick Flannery of Boondock Saints fame. And there's all the episodes are done in the style where a very old, like 90-year-old Indiana Jones, I don't know who the actor was, is kind of providing the wraparounds. But there's one episode in the middle of the run where it's actually Harrison Ford. He's, you know, once again at the end of an adventure and he holes up in some cabin and he starts to tell this story. Oh, this one time I was in, and then it goes into the episode. So that's the extent of my knowledge of the series.
Yeah, I remember it being on. I just, you know, wasn't watching at the time. So, I assume it'll show up on Disney Plus because it was probably done under Lucasfilm, which they now own. All right, so our cast for this movie, we have Harrison Ford returning again as Indiana Jones. We have Sean Connery as Henry Jones Sr. We have Denholm Elliott as Marcus Brody, as Tech said, reprising his role. Allison Duty, again, as Elsa Schneider. John Rhys-Davies as Salah. And Julian Glover as Walter Donovan. So the plot, we start off with, in 1912, a 13-year-old Henry Indiana Jones Jr. is horseback riding with his Boy Scout troop at Arks Natural Park in Utah. While scouting caves, Indy discovers a group of grave robbers who have found the golden crucifix belonging to Coronado. Steals it from them, hoping to donate it to a museum. The men give chase through a passing circus, leaving Indy with a bloody cut across his chin from a bullwhip and a new phobia of snakes. He escapes, but the local sheriff makes him return across to the robbers, who immediately turn it over to the mysterious benefactor wearing a Panama hat. Impressed by Indy's bravery, the leader of the robbers gives Indy his fedora, enough to encourage him not to give up. Yes, we spoke about that a little bit, but let's start with you, Tech. This is such a fun opening sequence, and it kind of, you know, basically it's Indy's backstory, where the, you know, his affinity for the whip came from, the fear of snakes and the fedora. What'd you think of this, this opening scene and sequence?
Oh, it's absolutely a blast. And like you said, some people can, you know, joke about it, that everything that makes Indiana Jones, Indiana Jones, happens to him in the course of one afternoon. You know, he gets the hat, he learns the whip, he gets the fear of snakes, he gets his scar and all that. It's, you know, it's like in Solo, the movie where, oh, he meets Chewbacca, he gets a Millennium Falcon, and he gets his gun all in the period of a week. But no, it's a great sequence because it's full. Initially, it's full of misdirects because, you know, you see this troop kind of moving through, you know, this magnificent landscape of the American, you know, West, and you don't really know what's going on. Then you really realize, oh, it's a Boy Scout troop. Okay, you know, that's the first kind of reveal. Next thing, you know, you see a guy from behind who you're led to believe is, oh, that's Indy's hat, that's his leather jacket, and he turns around and it's, you know, discount Indiana Jones. And then you realize that that's him up on the ledge as a teenager. And then you get the year. Oh, it's 1912. So it's just this series of where are we? When are we? Who are all these people? Until you finally realize, oh, we're in Indy's past. So it's not initially evident. And then, yeah, then it just goes. It just turns into another, you know, Indy cold open where everything he snatches something and all hell breaks loose. And, you know, you've got this great chase on this circus train, you know, as much of a spectacle as you can get. Yes. And of course, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but once again, scored by John Williams beautifully, you know, the entire sequence doesn't stop. It's like 8 straight minutes of action music and action. And then, yeah, then it, you know, it culminates in him getting home. You know, you kind of see, but mainly hear his father. You know, you don't quite get the reveal yet, but anyone who knows that voice, you know, knows who it's going to be. And then, yeah, Indy learns a hard lesson that, you know, grave robbing is not always going to end in your favor. And then, you know, smash cut, you know, he's been pursuing this Cross of Coronado for, you know, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Scott, give us any other thoughts you may have on the opening sequence with young Indy.
Little bit of a shocker, because like I knew that Sean Connery was in it, but a little bit of a shocker that you just see like basically a side view of him and not even his face.
It wasn't actually Connery; they dub in his voice.
Oh wow, wow! Mm-hmm. And you get a hint of their relationship that like is played out a little bit during the movie, because like Indy's trying to talk to him, and his dad makes him speak like count out loud in Latin. And then that's when he has to return the relic by that point because, you know, he shuts the door. And it's very interesting, yeah. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I've already said what I had to say.
Yeah. Eric, what do you think of the young Indiana Jones sequence?
I thought it was a lot of fun. It was very enjoyable. Jumping across different train cars is fun. Certainly when you know it's a circus train. All the various stuff that goes with it. This is the kind of like good backstory I like. Like I'm not always big on like I need to know the details behind the characters and such. Like, oh, here's the snakes and the bullwhip and stuff. Like, I guess this just works. I guess it's more. I like it more because it's coming right from Lucas himself. Like he has a real whole idea of Indy's life, his development. It seems he's got a better handle on that for one character compared to the whole Star Wars universe over six films. Mm-hmm. And that's just my opinion, but it was fun. It was just long enough. And it was a nice sequence, you know, connecting the past and present, getting the same idol back. So yeah, it was good.
Yeah,
it's good.
All right, cool. So in 1938, Indy battles Panama Hat once again and his henchmen on a ship off the storm-blasted coast of Portugal and escapes overboard just before the ship explodes. He recovers the cross and donates it to Marcus Brody's museum. Later on, he is introduced to Walter Donovan, who informs him that his father, Henry Jones Sr., has vanished while searching for the Holy Grail, using an incomplete inscription from a stone tablet as his guide. He then receives Henry's Grail Diary via mail from Vasily and heads there with Marcus, where they meet Henry's Austrian colleague, Dr. Elster Snyder. Beneath the library where Henry was last seen, Indy and Elsa discover a set of half-flooded catacombs that house the tomb of the first crusade knight that also contains the complete version of the inscription that Henry had used, revealing the location of the Grail. They flee when the petroleum-saturated waters of the catacombs are set aflame by the Brotherhood of the Cruciform Sword, a secret society that protects the Grail from evildoers. Indy and Elsa capture one of the Brotherhood members, Kazim, who tells Indy where Henry's being held after Indy explains that his only goal is to find his father, not the Grail. Looking through the diary, Marcus finds a map drawn by Henry of the route of the Grail, which begins in Alexandria. Indy then removes the map from the diary, gives it to Marcus for safekeeping, sends him to Iskenderun, a city built on the ruins of Alexandretta, to rendezvous with their old friend Salah. Elsa then, you know, begins a sexual relationship with Indy before they depart to find Henry. So, who do we leave off with this time? So we're going to start with Scott. Scott, what did you think of, you know, first of all, that ship goes down awfully fast off the coast of Portugal. And then, you know, this whole sequence. I don't trust Donovan from the get-go. And we'll find out. I was a little bit right there. And then, you know, Elsa is a smoke show. Again, something, though, I just didn't exactly trust that going into her. And I thought that was a great sequence, though, when they get into the catacombs and the ingenuity used to escape. And we also find out what Henry Sr.'s weakness is. It's rats. So, Indy was Jr. was snakes. Henry was rats. So everybody has a kind of an Achilles heel. So, Scott, talk about the whole sequence when we meet up with Indiana Jones in his present time.
Well, I liked with him finally getting the cross from the Peruvian hat guy. I thought that was good because it's like that's been on his mind since he was like 12 years old. So him finally able to come to closure with that. And then, see, I
hadn't seen this movie in so long that I was trusting that guy that Indy had met before, basically the Shadow Benefactor. Because he even gives him a warning at the end, don't trust anyone when they fly off to Italy. Yeah. So I wasn't trusting Elsie at all. I actually thought she was, before we found out what she was, I thought she was going to be someone that, like, when we meet Henry Jones, that he's going to be like, who is this lady? And that's when you find out that she had been playing him the whole time. But they do it a different way, which works just as well. I love the boat scene where Indy tells her to go around the boats, but she tries to thread the needle with the boats. And then you find out, this is something that when I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, the Mummy stole this idea of these people protecting the Grail, because you see these guys with a special tattoo and they are protecting the Grail, and they ask who. This just goes right with the Mummy when they're protecting Imhotep's grave with it as well. So I thought that was a nice little thing. And sort of to parallel, the Mummy was basically Indiana Jones for the early 2000s. So yeah, it was a nice little parallel with that, which I was thinking of when I watched this movie. But all in all, a good movie. They stay true to Indiana Jones form with these, like, first part. The rats were pretty terrifying, I'm not gonna lie, especially when they flip the boat over and they're hiding under the boat while the fire's going on, and you see the rats just going, not the boat, but the coffin, and you see the rats just burrowing through. That's a terrifying scene to me, and I don't really have a problem with rats, but with all of them trying to get in, that's horrifying. So that was a good scene as well. I just love it.
Yeah. Eric, what are your thoughts on the once we get to present day indie time?
I'm very enjoyable. Freeze sets things up right away. Search for the whale sounds like a lot of fun. The prospect of more of Indy caring about his father establishes his father's not like him in the sense that he's going to go out and do the job. He's more of a studier, more of a, I guess, a bookworm of sorts, not the adventurer that Indy is. So being concerned to find him. Brings Brody along, gets a much bigger part this time around. But it's good stuff. Certainly the boat chase, that's a lot of fun. That whole crossing between two bigger boats, that's always a fun, tense thing, sequence. So yeah, a really good stuff right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tech, what about you? We start off on the coast of Portugal with a great fight scene, and then we end up, setting the real plot of the movie in motion, and we make our way to Venice. What are your thoughts up until this point?
Yeah, that scene on the boat is a good button on the prologue. You know, you get your cold open again like the previous two movies, and this time we time jump about 20 years to kind of wrap this story up to show that he's been on this one for a while. And then, like I said earlier, we're back in familiar territory. He's back in the classroom, you know, much like how the guy Eaton and Musgrove come from the army to recruit him. He's taken by Donovan's men, who, you know, is, again, it's a misdirect where it's ominous. These guys in hats kind of surround him, and, you know, it turns out he's in this lavish, you know, upscale apartment. And, you know, in walks Julian Glover, who at this point his acting track record works against him, because you're kind of going to know he's the villain, because he's already terrorized, you know, the good guys in Star Wars. He's already terrorized James Bond. So he's got some nerd cred as a villain. But yeah, then the adventure just kicks off. Beautiful location in Venice. You know, we're back in the caves or catacombs, and just pure Indiana Jones. I'm a sucker for a good callback. So when they come across the etching of the Ark, and John Williams throws in the Ark theme there, mm-hmm. you know, that's enough to make me happy.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then yeah, that Venice boat chase, man, it's wonderful. That culmination at that propeller where he's got Kazim, you know, by the throat, and he's like, my soul is prepared. How is yours? This is a true believer. This is a guy who's ready to go down with the boat. So, and Indy knows that he might be in a little over his head on this one.
Yeah.
And then, then they kick it off from there.
Can you really trust, outside of Salah and Morocco Mole, can you really trust anybody in a Fez? So Indy and Elsa head to Nazi-controlled castle in Austria where Henry is being held. Indy finds Henry and frees him, only to be quickly captured by SS Colonel Ernst Vogel. He learns that both Elsa and Donovan are actually working with the Nazis and are using the Joneses to find the Grail for them. Elsa kisses Indy goodbye as she departs with Donovan and Vogel. Marcus is then captured in Hatte while meeting with Salah. After their escape from the castle, Harry tells Indy that the Grail is guarded by three booby traps, and his diary contains clues needed to safely pass by them. Disguised as an SS officer, Indy recovers the diary from Elsa at a book-burning rally in Berlin and actually comes face-to-face with Adolf Hitler, who autographs his book, not recognizing it or him. Henry and Indy then board a Zeppelin to leave for Germany, but are forced to escape in a parasite biplane. Once the Nazis discover them aboard, a dogfight with the Luftwaffe fighters ensue, although Henry and Indy are forced to crash land. They survive and successfully bring down their pursuers. A lot going on here where we get a lot of turns. We find out who the true colors are of some of the characters we've met. You know, he did tell them not to trust anybody, as Scott said. I pop big time for Salah being back. I remember him being in this movie, but, you know, like I said, it's been a while since I saw it, and he was one of my favorite characters from the first one, because this guy is just, he's one person, you know, Brody, you know, all that stuff, it's not going to turn on Indy. Indy's had a lot of people, you know, screw him over, so to speak, and, you know, Brody doesn't pick up on subtleties at all, and, you know, Vogel is pretty. It was probably is a big asshole in my opinion. He's one of the most, like, some of the villains, you know, you don't think are as jerks as much. This guy's just a dick, basically. Eric, what do you think when we get to Austria and we find out about Elsa and Donovan's true words, and then Henry the Great escape by Henry and Indiana Jones, and they make their way onto the Zeppelin?
Yeah, I felt fairly certain that Donovan was involved somehow. I guess mm-hmm. I was a little more surprised by Elsa's turn. I wasn't sure how she'd be involved. I wasn't sure if she'd be a big part at this point. But no, it was a nice change of pace for being in these girls. So, and then the later reveal that she slept with both Indy and her father is very funny. And he mm-hmm. says a line like she talks in her sleep. So
yes, that was funny.
Yes, the escape, the storming the castle in Austria is fun when he finds Henry, and Henry's just he's happy to see him, but he's also like he wouldn't do something foolish as like bring the book with him, which Indy actually does, and then their whole accidental escape via setting the place on fire, and then finding the secret compartment in the fireplace. I'm always down for like finding these secret rooms mm-hmm. in mansions or castles. So that was good. And then certainly getting to the book burning sequence, like that was something completely crazy. I didn't expect like there'd be this whole big sequence with all these extras and such. That's certainly memorable. I've never heard anything about that until I saw it on my TV. But the Zeppelin sequence is certainly that's a lot of fun. It's a lot of good character stuff. It's like Henry finally puts the book down. It's like, okay, you got me. Like, what do you want to talk about? Let's say they finally hash out their stuff, and Indy's like at a loss for words. I'm like, I don't know. So, but the escape is certainly fun. On the biplane, and Henry having to be the gunner. This yes. one, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a ton of stuff going on here. We have the, you know, like you said, the with the fireplace keeps swinging around. That, you know, done well, it's a great gag to have, which we've seen in many movies. We have, you know, the great chase sequence when they get out of the castle, where they kind of, you know, throw them off by thinking they go on the boat, and they go by motorcycle. And then they end up on the Zeppelin, and we have, you know, where Indy throws the guy out the window and gives the famous line, "No ticket," which, again, the second time we're mentioning Dogma tonight, that, you know, they yep. use that when they throw him out, when they throw Bartleby and Loki off the train. Silent Bob, is one of his two lines, I think, in that whole movie. He says, "No ticket." And then, yes, and they end up with a cameo by Adolf Hitler in this movie. So, Tech, what do you think of the action? So, once we get from Austria and the reveal of the, you know, the nefarious plot of Elsa and Donovan, and to, you know, we get the Zeppelin and into Germany.
Once Connery shows up in this movie, it just takes it in a whole new direction. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the dynamic between Ford and Connery makes this movie. Absolutely. It elevates it to a whole new level. And, you know, and it's a relationship that we haven't seen before. We've seen Indy dealing with Marion. We've seen him dealing with Willie. But here he's got a legit, you know, it's his dad, you know. He kind of has to hold his hand a little bit of the way, you know. He's not a field man, as he says earlier in the movie. And, you know, it's just these wonderful, wonderful moments shared between the two of them. The first one that comes to mind is during the motorcycle chase when, you know, Indy is so proud that he's dispatched these four Nazis on motorcycles. He looks at his dad with this big smile on his face, and his dad just kind of looking at him like, look what you did. And he's just winding his watch like he couldn't care less. It's wonderful. It's so well done between the two of them. The chemistry is just electric. But yeah, it's just one great scene after another. You know, you go from the, you know, the literally the dark and stormy castle, you know, kind of a cliched setting, but a lot of fun. Yeah, the fire, the escape, the motorcycle chase on its own is absolutely iconic. And again, Williams is just knocking it out of the park with an entire sequence with no dialogue, because, you know, he's all they have to rely on at that point, and he nails it. And then, yeah, we're on the Zeppelin. Again, you have a moment to take a breath. You know, the action has kind of died down. You inject some humor with the no ticket scene. And then, yeah, you get to see father and son really kind of their first moment together since, you know, reuniting, you know, where they can have a conversation. And you realize, like, oh, there's some tension here. You know, it's evident early on that there's maybe some resentment and everything. But Indy kind of lays it all out. You know, he says, you know, it was a difficult way to grow up. And but. You know, when it comes down to just talking about the quest, the Grail, the diary, you just see Connery, you see Henry's face just light up as he's, you know, the line on the Zeppelin is when he goes, what does that mean? He goes, I don't know, but we'll find out. He's just so excited. Yeah.
Yes. There's a eternal quest for knowledge. And then the great scene also with the using the birds on the beach as weapons to take down the Luftwaffe plane.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott, what'd you think of, so when we leave the castle, we get the heel turn, so to speak, the fun, chase scenes we get to leading up to the Zeppelin and into the, you know, the scene, the book burning scene with Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, actually when Indy sees his dad for the first time, like, Henry calls him Junior and Indy says, don't call him that. So it's like, oh, Indy has some daddy issues that we're going to work through with this movie. But, like, I did love, like, the no-ticket scene is great, and then everyone pulls out their ticket once Indy throws him off. But then when you find out when they're having a drink that Henry and Indy haven't spoken in 20 years, so there's definitely some friction there, but, you know, Henry still knew that he could trust him. And when they're being ran after by the planes, Henry goes, I think they're trying to kill us. And Indy goes, I know, Dad. And Henry goes, it's a new experience to me. And Indy's like, it happens to me all the time, which I thought was a great, like they have great chemistry, as Tech was saying, just how they go back and forth with each other, the little one-line zingers and everything. The book burning scene, when I watched it as a kid, like, I didn't grasp, like, the full reality of it. But after learning about, holy shit, that actually happened, and, like, him running into Hitler, it was just like, Jesus, I can't believe they threw this, like, you know, in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely different. But, like, he's starting to see that Elsie's starting to have a little bit of a baby face turn because she's, like, crying as they're burning the books and everything. And, you know, Indy runs into her, and that's how he gets the book back from her. It's because he takes it from her. So, and she doesn't alert anyone. So it's like, oh, you know, the wheels are turning type deal.
Yeah, she kind of goes with, I guess, who can best suit her needs at the time. So the two meet up with Salah and Hatte, where they learn of Marcus's abduction. The Nazis have equipped the Sultan of Hatte. You know, he's a big fan of Rolls Royces and are already moving towards the Grail's location using a map possessed by Marcus. Indy, Henry, and Salah find a Nazi exposition, which is ambushed by the Brotherhood. During the battle, Henry is captured by Vogel while attempting to rescue Marcus from a tank. Kazim and his comrades are killed. Indy pursues the tank on horseback with the aid of Salah, saves Henry and Marcus, He is caught up in a fight with Vogel, but escapes just before the tank goes off the off cliff, sending Vogel to his death. This is a great sequence. We have a great gunfight, and then the whole thing with the tank and Indy, you know, trying to survive, like, you know, not getting crushed by a wall or getting taken by the tread. Tech, talk about this. Now, you know, each one of the, we have lots of great scenes in each of these movies, but there's always one standout scene where with the action, and Indy kind of has to, you know, use his improvise and use his skills to get through it. So what do you think of this whole gunfight and then the tank scene?
Yeah, it's the centerpiece of the third act in terms of, you know, just action set pieces and all that. And, you know, you get another callback, you know, there's Indy on the horse, much like how, you know, he rode out of Cairo on the stolen horse. And, you know, this to much more dramatic effect, because it's essentially Indiana Jones on a horse versus a tank. So, you know, the odds are stacked against him to begin with. So there he is, you know, trying to come up with whatever he can. You know, he very basic stuff. He finds a rock, he shoves it into the barrel, and, you know, banana peels one of the guns. So he's just kind of chipping away at him. You know, all the while, you know, Henry and Marcus are inside, you know, dealing with their own, you know, stuff. They find their own way to deal with the Nazis who are holding them captive. You know, Indy ends up on the top of the tank, and it's just one Nazi after another is coming at him, either from trucks alongside or down below. It just doesn't stop. And once again, you know, you've got a big action scene with sporadic dialogue. So there's John Williams just blasting you with this fantastic piece, you know, Belly of the Steel Beast, as Sala refers to it. And, you know, there's that moment at the end where it's just him and Vogel. They're beating the crap out of each other. And the tank is quickly approaching that cliff. And something that you never think would happen happens. Indiana Jones's hat blows off. That's how you know things have gotten so real.
Yes.
You know, this fantastic close-up of Harrison Ford, you know, wide-eyed. You said before, you know, he's so expressive when it comes to stuff like this. You know, zoom in on his blue eyes. The hat blows off, you know, which really makes you wonder, like, it's almost a Samson allegory. You know, this is, you know, a character who gets his power and his strength from his hair. This is a guy who, whenever he's got this hat on, he's pretty much, he can get the shit beat out of him, but he's still pretty much unstoppable.
Yeah.
So one might worry, like, oh my God, his hat got blown off. Is this it for him? Is he actually going to go over the cliff? And, you know, you have this moment, this somber moment where everybody thinks that he's met his end and, you know, he's all right. You know, they kind of dust themselves off. And then the hat just blows right back to him with the breeze. It's like, yes. You know,
always find his way back.
Yeah, this is God giving you a thumbs up that your job is not over. You have to beat the Nazis. Here's your hat.
Great. Yep. Scott, what are your thoughts with the tank fight and the demise of Vogel?
The tank fight, I just loved it. You know, Indy really outsmarted all the Nazis, which is one thing I love, is seeing Nazis getting outsmarted in these movies. Because like I like when he puts the rock when they're shooting at it and it like explodes pretty much, and like they can't use the gun anymore. I just thought that was genius. I don't know if it would work in real life, but I loved it. The fight with Vogel was pretty intense, but it was nice to see him like get his desserts, as they say. And like I love how Henry thinks that Indy's dead. He's like, I would have just spent 5 minutes telling him how much he meant to me. And then Indy crawls up, and Henry just looks at him and was like, all right, come on, let's go. So I wish they would have had more moments together in this movie, because their chemistry was just off the charts.
Yeah, great stuff. Eric, what do you think of this sequence?
It's really fun. It's fun riding in a horse, taking out a tank. That's always very interesting. Now, I assume the tank and everything was also provided by the Sultan, who they trade pretty much one of their cars for. That was a fun little thing. Like, they bring him all these riches and this chest of jewels and such. It's like, I really like this car. And all that. So, that's funny. Sorry, Henry accidentally getting taken with Marcus in the tank, and then sieging the tank from outside and inside. Henry fighting off the Nazi to get the Ruger loot. Ruger, how do you pronounce that gun name? Luger? Yeah.
You got me.
But yeah, basically it fights him off and then scores him in the eye with his pen. I thought he was going to stab him. I was like, that's the most obvious thing you do. But no, he just squirts pen in his eye. Might be worse in some ways.
The pen is more chill than the sword.
Yes, yes. Marcus makes sure to say, geez. And I think he gets knocked out. It's beat up a lot, intentionally. But no, the sermon, the fight between Indy and Fogel was a lot of fun. I almost wish he stayed around a little longer as they get to the Grail, but it was very enjoyable as it was. Fighting on the tank and in the tank, leaning to off the cliff. It's just a wonderful end. And certainly Indy's survival rate is just incredible. Like, of course he's going to drop down and sit down. He's very tired by this point. He needs at least 2 days rest. So he can't.
Yep. So then we, Indy, Henry, Marcus, and Salah catch up with the surviving Nazis led by Donovan and Elsa, who have found the temple where the Holy Grail is kept, but unable to pass the first of 3 protective traps. Donovan shoots and mortally wounds Henry in order to force Indy to risk his life in the traps to find the Grail and use his healing power to save his father. So the 3 trials of the Breath of God with the penitent man will pass. We have to kneel before him. The word of God, only in the footsteps of God, he proceeds the name of God. I'm trying to read my own writing here. The path of God, the leap from the lion's head, the leap of faith was an optical illusion. So then, you know, he gets through it using the information in the diary followed by Donovan and Elsa. He safely overcomes the traps, which, you know, like I just mentioned, which actually include a fast moving saw blade. So as you kneel, the blade goes above your head. A word puzzle, which is you have to know Jehovah, which actually starts with an I in, I think it's Latin.
Yes, Latin. Yeah. Latin.
Or Hebrew, whatever it is. So he has to spell it out. And if you don't step on those, you'll fall through. And a hidden bridge over a bottomless pit. He then reaches the Grail's chamber, which is guarded by a knight. The knight has been kept alive for 700 years by the power of the Grail, which is hidden among dozens of false Grails. Only a true Grail, the true Grail, grants eternal life, which, while a false one, would kill the drinker. Elsa intentionally selects a wrong cup for Donovan, causing him to rapidly age and fall into dust after drinking from it. Kind of reminiscent of the face-melting scene from the first one. Indy then drinks from a simple clay cup that proves to be the true Grail. But the knight warns that it cannot be taken out of the temple and that its guardian must stay within in order to remain immortal. So a lot going on here. We get the great trials and the chosen of the cup. So Tech, so we have, you know, Indy has no choice in order to save his father's life. He's got to, you know, help the Nazis out, and he goes to 3 trials. Talk about this. This is probably like overall in terms of Indy, you know, using his brain, and you see Henry kind of mouthing along as it goes. This is probably one of my favorite sequences in the whole franchise.
I agree. When I was young, I would, dare I say it, I would fast forward most of the movie just to get to this scene. Because I absolutely just, I love the traversal of the 3 traps and all that. You know, I don't know what it was. It just captivated me. Yeah, the first one with the saw blades. Even leading up to that, you see the guy with the getting beheaded.
Yes.
We need another volunteer, you know. And then, yeah, the name puzzle and all that. But then, yeah, that third one with that cool effect of the painted bridge to blend into the rock face there, which, of course, only works from one specific angle if you really want to nitpick it. But it doesn't matter because it's really cool.
Yes.
And then, yeah, he, you know, there's this knight who's, you know, centuries old because he's been given eternal life by the Holy Grail. And yeah, like you said, Donovan getting smitten by God is reminiscent of the ending of Raiders and all that. But it culminates with Indy, you know, realizing, you know, the humble nature of Jesus and what kind of a grail or cup would this man drink from. And he says that's the cup of a carpenter. And he's got this simple clay cup that is the one true grail. Yeah, I always loved it. Absolutely always loved this sequence. Great, great final climax to this film.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what do you think of the trials and, the choosing of the grail?
I thought the trials were great. And I love they would show like Indy working out in his head, and then they would flash back to Henry being held by Salah and be like, the penitence man, the penitence man, the penitence man, which was great, you know, when with all that stuff going on. And then like you go and you see the knight, and the knight's like, oh, is that what knights look like now? Because he had been stuck in there for 700 years. So the knight was like, oh, you dress funny. So that was a nice little comedic moment. And then you see like Elsa betrays the Nazi, betrays, and you think she may be a good guy, but then we'll see what happens with her. But I love that one of the things with the Grail is that the Grail can't leave. You can't take it with you. That's what the knight tells you. It's like, you have to stay here to be immortal. So I thought that was a nice little play on it, because the guy that just died, he thought he would live forever, but he didn't realize he would have to live forever in there. He didn't get that opportunity to find out, but it was a nice little play on it. And, you know, Indy's able to save his dad, who had been shot. So that's how they got him to do the trials. And the optical illusion scene I thought was great. That was a nice little way of how they did it with the technology back then. Now, as we spoke earlier, it would be easy to do, but that was just mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great sequence. Eric, what are your thoughts on Indy making his way through the trials and then the choosing of the Grail?
It's really good. I mean, obviously, it's the ultimate motivator is trying to save your father from a gunshot wound. Obviously, he knew he would have time because as he learned to wrestle with dogs, it takes days to die from a gutshot wound. So, but yeah, the huge saw blades, that first sequence is, wow, really crazy. It's good that he knew not only to kneel, but also to roll from two saw blades. I was doing it really bad. The second one is good. It's a little more, I guess, clever and such. I don't really know Latin at all, so I wouldn't know if that would start with an I or not. But certainly the third one, the leap of faith. Because I was thinking at this point, I was like, does he have his whip? Did he lose his whip? I don't think we've seen a lot of whip action at this point in the film. But no, just turned out to be like a good optical illusion. And then like he made sure to throw sand behind it so that, because he knew like Devin or Elsa wouldn't think to figure that out, I guess. And yeah, mean the knight, and you must choose wisely, my first thought was it'd probably be like the Grail looked nice, probably have a little bit some jewels and such, very class it up. But no, he just went simple. Just like, this is what Carpenter make in like a half hour. It's good.
Yeah. So, a tremendous sequence of events. So then Indy then fills the proper Grail with the holy water, brings it to Henry, healing him instantly. Elsa disregards the knight's warning and tries to take the Grail with her, causing the temple to collapse around them. And then when she crosses the great seal set in the floor at the entrance, the Grail falls into a chasm and Elsa plummets to her death trying to recover it. Indy nearly suffers the same fate before Henry convinces him to leave it. The Joneses, Marcus and Salah, escape the temple as the Grail Knight watches them leave and ride off into the sunset. So, Scott, let's talk about Elsa and her ultimate undoing, or her demise, so to speak, and how we end this film.
It was very fitting because it was her own hubris that got in the way of it. She was being greedy because the knight, her and Indy clearly said, don't take it out of here. And then after Indy heals Henry, she tries to step away and she causes like the chasm to collapse. And then with her being selfish, you know, she's holding on to gloves and you see them slipping when Indy's holding on to her and she falls to her death. Which is there, and it almost costs Indy his life because he tries to grab it too. But Henry, just who his whole life has been said in this movie, he is obsessed with the Grail, and he tells Indy to walk away from it. And I just love that. It was him and his dad coming together at the end, and I love the one of the last lines that they see that you hear is like Salah asking, was like, why do you call him Junior? And he goes, Henry Jones, and then points at Indy and says Junior. And he's like, Indiana. And Henry goes, that was the dog's name. So Indy took his name from their dog, which you saw in the beginning of the movie, which I loved. And he goes, I had a lot of good memories with that dog. It was just, I just loved it. Because I almost spoiled, I was watching this with my wife and I almost spoiled it for him. I was like, but I'm saying, hey, you know he's named after that dog, right? But then they didn't mention it. So I was like, I'll just keep that to myself. But it's just something that has stuck with me is like, and something that's very interesting when we get to our next movie with the naming of people.
Yeah, we named a dog Indiana. I always love that. Eric, what do you think of the, you know, Elsa done messed up and pays for it, and we end the movie. What do you think of this final sequence?
Yeah, I mean, even if she's conflicted about working with the Nazis, she's still working with the Nazis, so she had to have some pay some penance for that. Even if it's by accident, by backing away, back into the symbol on the floor. Like, that's the cutoff. Can't take the grail anywhere else. But, yeah, falling into a bottomless pit. I mean, it was bound to happen in these movies. So, hopefully it was a quick death. But that's all I can ask for at this point. But, it's good. It's like Henry gets healed. Like, he drinks. It's good that, like, he drinks the stuff and he also has it pour over his wound. Like, you want to be sure, double sure that's going to work. And, yeah, then it's like the place collapses around them. The night seems okay with, like, finally being able to just be done with this. Like, just be on his way. Like, he's pretty much asking for death at this point. And our heroes are off in the sunset with a little bit of a backstory revealed on the Indian name. It's funny. Mark is thinking, I can lead the way out of here. And they joke, like, he once got lost in his own museum. That's something. So, yeah, a nice way to end the movie. The four of them ride off into the sunset, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Tech, what do you think of Elsa, you know, basically her greed and her, you know, her, as Scott said, hubris gets the best of her. And, you know, and then the closing sequence with the reveal of the origin of the Indiana name.
Yeah, Scott pretty much nailed it. You know, hubris is definitely the word to use. And again, it's yet another kind of left turn after a series of them where you think, oh, she's turned. You know, she's gonna, you know, turn to the light side here, so to speak. But then, yeah, she done screwed up at the end. You know, so she's not gonna get to ride off with them. He doesn't get to whip her by the waist and smooch her as the credits roll. So yeah, I think she got what she deserved after screwing everybody over. But yeah, then we end it with that great moment with the four of them. Yeah, we get that reveal, the dog's name, always good for a laugh. And then yeah, the callback to Indy earlier in the movie saying, you know, Marcus, he got lost in his own museum, and then he's, I know the way. And Connery, you know, gets the callback on that. Got lost his own museum, huh? And yeah, it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, how it seemed pretty definitive at the time with the, albeit cliched, ride off into the sunset, that this would be the end. This was the conclusion of a trilogy of these characters, these adventures. And surprise, 2008, we're not done.
Yes, we'll get to that in just a minute. So final thoughts on Last Crusade, which, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, it bypassed, you know, in their rankings on I don't know if it's the addition of Connery or you know, the ending trial sequence, but Eric, where does this rank, and if you have any other final thoughts on this movie?
This is definitely number two behind Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
Strong number two, yeah. It's a good story. The story of the Ark, the Holy Grail itself. Indy's dad, he's a great addition. He doesn't take away, he adds to the story. Just fun action sequences. Certainly it's not as good as Raiders, because I think obviously Bog is the best villain of this whole four. Force them. I think there could be a consensus from all of us on that. So I think really that's the only issue at hand. But still, it's like Indy fighting Nazis. was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, anytime Nazis get beat up, it's a good time. So, yep. Tech, where is this rank? And well, you said rank number one. I don't know where you would put Temple of Doom and Raiders after this, but and any final thoughts on Last Crusade?
God, I love this movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's yeah, it's tremendous.
It's absolutely number one. It's Crusade, Raiders, Doom. At process of elimination, you can guess what number four is. But it's just, I love it so much. I love how it plays out. I love the dynamic between Ford and Connery, and as a result, Indy and his father. The, you know, bringing back Sulla, bringing back Marcus. You know, Allison Duty is very easy on the eyes. She always said that it was a hell of a thing for a young Irish girl to be thrown into this big movie where she has to play a Nazi. I'm like, but she pulled it off. You know, I'll give her credit. And yeah, like I think the Grail theme is one of the greatest things John Williams has ever written in his entire career. That's just my opinion. I think it's beautiful. I think it's incredibly memorable. It's got a very powerful, you know, theme behind it, you know, thematically behind the music. And yeah, just great action sequences, great writing, great music, all in all, 100%.
All right, cool. And Scott, what are your, ranking and final thought of the Crusade?
So this slides in number two for me. I enjoyed this movie. As Tech said, it's a lot of fun. Just everything with it. As we've been doing this podcast, we've been doing this since June, I believe. We've seen that the third movies usually suck. This is an exception to that rule. I thought it was a great movie, and if they wanted to end it here, it would have been great. They didn't end it, but I will get to with our thoughts on that as well. But I just enjoyed it all. But at the end of the day, it left me still wanting more Indy. So, mm-hmm. Which is something all these movies do, which is a mark of a good movie. It's not like, hey, I never want to see these people again. It's like, kind of want to see some more adventures between these guys.
Yeah. And we do. 19 years later, in 2008, we have Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Again, I saw this in theaters. I think I'm the only one who's seen all four. I can pretty much safely say I did see this in the same day I saw Iron Man. They both came out around the same time. I really enjoyed one movie, and I didn't enjoy one not nearly as much. Although, when I did my rewatch, it was better than I remember. I did not completely hate the entire movie. There are some parts of it that I'm like, oh, God. And Shia, just... why Shia? But let's kind of go around and initial thoughts going in because of the big gap. So we'll start with Tech, actually. Tech, what were your thoughts when we found out Indy was coming back, and your initial thoughts on the film?
I couldn't help but be excited. You know, mm-hmm. having been very familiar with the series, loving the series for years and years, and then to know, all right, it's actually going to happen. You know, it had been kicked around for years. Oh, they may do another one. They may do another one. All right, it's finally happening. All right, what's it going to be called? Who's going to be in it? You know, I remember speculating when John Hurt got cast, there was a rumor going, oh, he's going to play Abner Ravenwood. He's not actually dead. And I was like, that could be cool. And that didn't end up being true. Hell, there was an early rumor that Natalie Portman was going to be Indy's daughter in this movie, never mind Shia LaBeouf as his son. So who knew what to believe? And then, you know, I got the score at one point, and I got the score before the movie came out, and in an early track, the Ark theme is in there. I'm like, the Ark theme is in this movie. What are the, you know, all these questions are in my mind. So there I am in the theater, and I'm with, I saw it with a friend of mine who I remember this so specifically. I think it was about maybe a half hour. It's whenever they're in the graveyard, and they're mm-hmm. crawling through the tunnels under the graveyard. And he just turns to me in the theater, he whispers, he goes, we're watching a new Indiana Jones movie. Like, he was just so excited, and I couldn't help but feel the same way. And, you know, as it went on, I'm like, all right, you know, Harrison's looking a little worse for wear, but, you know, it's Indiana Jones, so you just kind of let it go. And, you know, I remember hearing that Sean Connery said that even though he was retired, the one thing that would make him come out of retirement was another Indiana Jones movie. That didn't happen. So sadly, they had to write him out and kill off the character. Sadly, Denham Elliott had already passed, so we couldn't see him again. But, you know, our returning character was Marion. So it was fun to see Karen Allen again and kind of have that, you know, familiar piece to it. But the one thing that I always cite as the thing I enjoy about this movie is the entire motorcycle chase sequence is filmed in New Haven, Connecticut.
Yes.
Which is roughly 5 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And I was actually, if I could just tell a quick tangent for a second here, mm-hmm. I actually walked onto the set while they were shooting in New Haven. It was the second unit. It was the stunt guys. I saw the two stunt doubles for Shia LaBeouf and Harrison Ford in their costumes setting up a run for the sequence and the motorcycles. And, you know, down the street, I could see people in period costumes and all this. And it was a cool thing to see. And, you know, sadly, I didn't get to see any, you know, Harrison Ford or Steven Spielberg or anything. But so this movie kind of has a very unique place in my heart, as, you know, quality aside, you know, I was on the set of this movie, technically.
Yeah, it's always fun when you happen upon that. I don't know if you guys remember the movie Riding in Cars with Boys. They shot that, a lot of that in parts of Westchester, including Tuckahoe, New York, where they turned this one main street, which I would drive on all the time, into, you know, look like the 1950s, I think it was. You had like a Swanson dinner billboard. They took a diner and turned it into a movie theater from the outside, and another like pop-up like burger stand. Yeah, it was fun to drive through. And when you pop on those things, especially something like, you know, I don't have an affinity for that. I just, you know, when I've seen the movie, I'm like, oh yeah, I recognize it. But, you know, if something that you really love and you mark out for, I can imagine that every time you watch it, you kind of get like a little giddy that you're like, I was there. I saw that. Yeah. It must've been really cool experience for you to have. All right. Yeah. Scott, so what did you think when they announced the return of Indy and your initial thoughts on Crystal Skull?
I was so excited for it. Like I said, I only watched the first three movies on VHS at my grandmother at my granny's house. So it was great. I was like, oh, I'm finally going to be able, like, sort of how, you know, Tex and his friend was, I'm finally going to be able to, you know, experience the Indiana Jones movie in the theater. And I'd only seen the movie once in theaters before I watched it for this pod. And I remember, like, being like sort of like how you were, Andy, like, oh, I don't really like this movie. But actually on the second viewing, I liked it a lot, because some of the things that I had an issue with, which we'll get to, after watching the other three movies, it fits in perfectly in my eyes. So, like, some of the stuff that I've seen was far-fetched, was great. Like, and I think the Shia LaBeouf thing may not make sense in current times, but during that time, he was on top of the world. He was
hot.
He was seen as like the next big thing. And I think personally he's a great actor, because I loved him in Peanut Butter Falcon and Honey Boy. You guys should check those movies out. But at the time, like, he was doing Transformers, which was a huge success. So I can see why they wanted some new blood in here for that. Like Tex said, it's upsetting that Sean Connery couldn't make it. I wish they would have been able to bring back Salah, because I know that he's still alive. But with the actors they brought in, I really liked. It was nice to see Miriam come back. But like I said, this movie definitely, like, the issues I had the first time watching it are non-existent the second time.
All right. Eric, you probably had heard about, like, you know, Indy's return after such a long period of time. And what are your initial thoughts on Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
Yes, I certainly heard about they're finally doing it. They're doing a fourth one. It's this whole thing. It's like they're getting Ford back, and they're putting Shia, who's like Spielberg's new golden boy, since he had also produced like Transformers and such. And I was like, I knew Lucas could be involved, and I was kind of burnt down Lucas from like the end of the prequel trilogy. You know, I did like a Revenge of the Sith. So, but I certainly, I wasn't really familiar with it. I certainly heard a lot more about it around the time that fall when the South Park episode aired. They got their feelings out about it. They thought that Lucas and Spielberg literally raped Indiana Jones. So, but I wasn't really keen to visit the movie. Like, doing a sequel almost 20 years later after the last one, and for any franchise, is a risky endeavor. So. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really motivated but just like obviously you picked this, so I was like, okay, I'm gonna finally sit down and watch it. And I had some interesting thoughts about it. So let's get into it.
Yeah. And actually, Tech, you are correct about the daughter part, because they introduced in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicle, old Indy is showing to have a daughter. And the idea was incorporated into the script with Indy and Marion having a 13-year-old daughter. However, Spielberg thought it found it too similar to The Lost World Jurassic Park. So they put a son in the script instead. So kind of, I don't know.
That's the movie that was on everybody's mind when this movie.
Yeah. So let's kind of go through the cast. So we have Harrison Ford, who comes back at the age of 64 as Indiana Jones. We have Kate Blanchett joining as Irina Spalko, a villainous Soviet agent with quite the wig she wears. Karen Allen returns as Marion Ravenwood under the married name Marion Williams. Ray Winstone as George Mack McHale. John Hurt as Harold Ox Oxley. Jim Broadbent as Dean Charles Danforth, who kind of stands in for the Marcus Brody character, and Shia LaBeouf as Mutt Williams. So in 1957, Indiana Jones and his partner George Mack McHale have been kidnapped from their archaeological excavating work in Mexico by Soviet agents working under Irina Spalko, who infiltrates a secret governmental Nevada warehouse labeled Hangar 51 and forced Jones to locate a mummified corpse from the Roswell UFO incident 10 years earlier, on which he was forced to work. Shortly after, Mack reveals that he has become a double agent on the KGB's payroll after an unsuccessful attempt to retrieve the body and a fight with Spalko's henchman, Dovchenko. Jones escapes to a model town in Nevada test site right before an atomic bomb test. He takes shelter in a lead-lined refrigerator and is rescued, decontaminated, interrogated by FBI agents who suspect him for working for the Soviets. Though freed from the recommendation of General Ross, he ends up put on indefinite leave of absence from Marshall College, and the dean resigns to keep Indiana's job at the college. So, Scott, what do you think of this sequence, you know, with the whole Hangar 51 and the... you know, the escape from it with and the whole thing with the magnetic forces that we see that magically help find this thing, and then the you know, the whole sequence in the town, and we find out Mac basically turns on him, and we get we kind of figure out like where we're at now and where this movie is supposed to head.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a hot start, like the rest of these movies have been. And you see a little bit different this time, where, you know, Indy's a little bit older. You know, he's being pulled out of the back of the car. And instead of Nazis, as this has been set before in the 30s, you know, all three movies were set in the 30s. This is set in the 50s. The enemies this time are the Russians. As if you guys may remember, this is the height of the Cold War, and also McCarthyism, as when he's being interrogated later on, they accuse him of being a commie. So, and you know, there's even where Tech was on set, there was actually, when they're just jumping ahead a little bit, there was like red, like a some type of protest taking place with like the fear of the red wave of communism. Mm-hmm. So, that was just pretty interesting. It's nice, like, you know, Spielberg and Lucas dabble with, like, putting in the Nazi stuff in the movies. And with this one, they do McCarthyism, which I thought was interesting. But the whole thing that I had, like, with seeing the alien, you know, I love how Indiana Jones just goes with it, because everything he's seen, you know, what's not to suspect that aliens are real? And, you know, with them discussing, like, I was brought out to somewhere in... in 1947, it takes you a while. It's like, holy shit, he's talking about Area 51. So that was a nice little surprise. And the thing that I had a problem with the first time I saw it, and I remember a lot of people in articles were having an issue with, is the nuking of the fridge, where, you know, Indy jumps in the fridge, which is lead lined, and, like, you know, he survives the nuclear blast. So, you know, a lot of people had issues with it at first, but after watching these movies in order, it's not as bad as the scene in the second movie where they take the raft down from the airplane and then just go through the snow there and then land in the water. What's so different with that? So that, like, I think when people were reviewing this movie, they were not taking they're putting it in like current times instead of like throwing it in the Indiana Jones universe. So that's just my opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eric, what do you think of the scene in the warehouse and then, you know, the explosion and where we end up?
It starts out well enough. You know, this is obviously it's different. It's 19 years after the fact, and you know, Lucas wants to do his take on the 50s sci-fi, which I'm cool with. I like that we're at the base, which we saw at the end of Raiders. I mean, because we briefly see the Ark is there. We're quickly filled in. Obviously, like there's a lot to establish, like 19 years after the fact. So I'm not really feeling Mac's betrayal because Mac is a whole new character. But I get where they're going for. Like they're telling us right away what this is. This is gonna be aliens, and then the sequence, the escape sequence from it, the facility leading to the town. I'm very maligned on the whole fridge sequence. I mean, it's just different in itself because it's obviously, you know, it's a 2008 film. It's much more CG heavy movie for all their big action sequences. I really don't enjoy it. I don't like it. I'd be fine with the sequence from Temple of Doom where they fly out of the airplane. It's ridiculous enough, but yeah, it's the fridge sequence is one of several sequences that I get like really taken out of the movie. I feel like it's just a step too far. Mm-hmm. So it's not just this. It's obviously the biggest example, but it's not the only one.
Yeah. All right. And Tech, what are your thoughts? You know, is this where we hear the theme? Because I mean, I was more paying attention to taking notes, but is this where we hear the theme that you? From the soundtrack that you had thought, and you see the because they do make we do see it, right? We have crate.
The subtlety goes right out the window with this mm-hmm. opening sequence of this movie. Yes. Because you know, there it is plastered on the sign, you know, Hangar 51. We're like, all right, I think we know what we're doing with this. And then they get there, and when they open the doors, this is giant 51 on the hangar doors, and it's clearly the warehouse from the end of Raiders. And then, yeah, that's where we get the Ark theme. And I'm like, okay, that's establishing the connection. This is the warehouse. And then at the end of that chase sequence, somebody bashes a crate and you see the Ark, and there's one more instance of the theme. And I'm like, oh, that's it. It's more of a cameo than anything else. Nothing to do with the rest of the plot. But after that, my biggest takeaway, I'll talk about the fridge real quick. The most jarring thing about that whole sequence is how out of place Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones, looks running around a brightly colored 1950s neighborhood and home. Yeah. Because there he is in, you know, his beige shirt with his satchel and his hat and his brown pants. This is an outfit we've seen him wearing in multiple jungles and, you know, deserts and everything. And here he is in a neighborhood. And it just looks so odd. You know, plus the fact that he's, you know, older and more grizzled. That's the weirdest thing. But my biggest takeaway from this whole opening is when he's being debriefed, interrogated, whatever you want to call it, by the FBI guys, in walks the general, who refers to him as Colonel Jones, and you know, making reference to his, you know, his career essentially during World War II and whatever after that. And I'm like, I want to see that movie. Can we stop this right here and go back to that? I want to see Indiana Jones's army career, but alas, you know, we've missed that time, and here we are.
Yes. So, you know, Indy's, and then, you know, after he loses his job and all that, he is approached by a greaser, Mutt Williams, who tells him Harold Oxley found a crystal skull in Peru and was later kidnapped along with his mother, Marion, who went after him. Jones tells Mutt of the legend of crystal skulls found in Akator, and Mutt gives him a letter from his mother with a riddle from Oxley in an ancient language. Two Soviet agents attempt to capture them, but Jones and Mutt escape. Following the riddle, they reach Peru at a local psychiatric hospital. Oxley's scribblings on the walls and floor of his cell lead them to the grave of Francisco de Orellana, a conquistador who searched for Akator. They find the skull at the grave, with Jones reasoning Oxley had returned it there. So, Eric, we really get the motion of with the crystal skull in place, and the introduction of of Mutt with a fun chase scene, which through New Haven, Connecticut. So, what'd you think of this whole thing where we kind of put the events in action with the traveling to the exotic location and the introduction of Mutt?
The introduction of Mutt. I'm fine with him. I guess it just leaned so much into the greaser thing. I guess it's just a little out of it. But, obviously it's the 50s, so that's what it's going to be. So I do like the chase sequence on the bike. Again, with the Russians around New Haven. That is fun, especially as they fall into the library and slide underneath several tables. And just that one kid is just like completely unfazed about it. Like, just the ultimate bookworm. I'm like, Mr. Jones, what's the next thing we're supposed to study and such? Like, that's a fun little capper on that. Establishing the crystal skulls. I had no idea what the crystal skulls would end up being by this point. So we're off to the races, and I am enjoying their dynamic. They're between Mutt and Indy right away. Mutt is coming across a little too much like a prick, but it's fine. It's early enough that it's fine. So and then we get to Peru. And off of the races there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get, Mutt, obviously, they are playing into the greaser thing. He's constantly fixing his hair. He's kind of an asshole a little bit, the way he, sticks his comb in the soda and just, is a tough guy. And there's a lot of throwaway exposition, talks about, getting out of school and he was doing fencing, which, pays off later on. So, Tech, what do you think of this outside of the fact that it was a film right near where you live, but the whole sequence when we introduce Mutt and then we end up in Peru looking for Ox's cell and stuff?
Yeah, the introduction it's odd to think about in the long run, because the first shot of him, he's on his motorcycle with the black leather jacket, the hat. He's essentially a duplicate of Marlon Brando in The Wild One. But nothing comes of that. Like, it was clearly just a style choice, either just for the movie, or because there's nothing about the character who's like, oh, I saw this movie and, he's trying to emulate it. It just kind of is. So right from the get-go, it's like, all right, this is the style, whatever. But yeah, like you said, the stuff in the diner, we're establishing that he's a hothead, he's quick to jump down somebody's throat if they say the wrong thing. It's an interesting way to get some exposition out, and introduce the character at the same time. And then, the chase is fun. I get a kick out of it, 'cause I'm like, ooh, I know where that is, but, that aside, you can't help but kind of have almost an immediate dislike of this character, because there's almost nothing redeeming about him. And anyone who, even had a modicum of sense going into this, they're like, I kind of know where this is going in terms of who this kid is going to end up being. They try to misdirect with the different last name and, my mother, Mary Williams, nobody calls her that. Her name is Barry. And, so he's just difficult to latch onto. Like what you guys said earlier about Mac, how you have no investment in this relationship because you've just met this character. Like, we're expected to understand that there's history between them. It's like in the beginning of Attack of the Clones in Star Wars, where you've just met teenaged Anakin, and there he is in an elevator with Obi-Wan Kenobi, and they're trying to force feed the audience like, oh, this is worse than that time we were in that nest of Gundarks. Remember that? And it's like, ugh, all right, we get it. You're force feeding us backstory. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would have meant more if you had somebody like Brody turning, on that. Somebody that we had met and established. If Salah had turned.
Absolutely.
If they brought him back, that would have been something. So, Scott, what do you think of, we introduce Mutt. We have that nice, fun motorcycle chase through New Haven, and then we end up in Peru looking for Ox.
Yeah, they were a little heavy-handed with making Mud a greaser. It's like, okay, I get it. I've seen The Outsiders. but, like, you know, with him being quick-tempered, because, like, when he says my name, my mom, Mary, and Indy's like, well, I know a lot of women named Mary. He's like, hey, that's my mother I'm talking about. It's like, hey, relax. Relax, kid. First off, Indy probably has, like, 15 kids floating around the world. So, you know, you're not too special. But, with them going to Peru, it's nice because, like, I think they did this because maybe in real life Harrison Ford's a little older, so they need someone else to do some of the heavy lifting. So that was nice for him to basically have, like, an apprentice while, like, Indy can say, like, oh, hold this for me, do this and do that. So it was nice with that, and I like with Peru, you hear about this person named Ox, and he's like, yeah, he was pretty boring as a person, but now he's the most interesting. Andy says, you've never been this interesting as a person when he loses his mind. And you see that he lost his mind in a cell because he's writing Return and drawing these weird pictures of skulls. So we're like, oh, we're off to something here. And then we have, I will say, the scene in the Peru where the caskets are was pretty creepy with the I guess they're, I don't know, something to ward off grave robbers are running in and out, and like it's a crazy scene. It's pretty freaky.
Mm-hmm. It's a little scary. These guys kind of just pop out. You see eyes looking almost like a Scooby Doo kind of thing, and with the poison darts. So then Jones and Mutt are captured by Mac and the Soviets, taken to their camp in the Amazon jungle. Spalko believes the crystal skull belongs to an alien life form and holds great psychic power. And finding more skulls in Akator will grant the Soviet Union the ability to take control of the world through the use of telepathy. Spalko threatens to kill Mutt if Jones doesn't help. When that doesn't work, he threatens to kill Marion. Spalko uses the skull on Jones to enable him to understand Oxley and identify a route to Akator. Jones and his allies try to escape, but Marion and Jones get caught in a dry sand pit when Marion reveals that Mutt is his son, Henry Jones III, and are recaptured by the Soviets. While on their way to Akator, Jones and his team fight their way out of the KGB clutches. Mac tells Jones that he is a CIA double agent, and Dovichenko is devoured by ants. After surviving three waterfalls in an amphibious vehicle, Jones and Oxley identify a skull-like rock foundation that leads them to Akator, unaware that Mac lied about being a CIA agent and that has been dropping transceivers to allow the surviving Russians to track them. The whole mind control thing and all that, I kind of was, getting lost on, but, I thought the reveal was fun, with he throws him a line and that just happens to be a snake, and they can't understand why, Indy all of a sudden is, afraid of things after everything that, the short time that Mutt's known him. The reveal is fun, I think, and that sequence, a little, over the top at times. I love the ants, and then Marion, returns to form from Raiders with her, her guts and her gumption and everything like that. But it looked like a fun ride. I like to go on a theme park going down those, the three waterfalls. But Tex, so what do you think of this whole sequence where we get, we really learn what the Soviets are after, and then the reveal of, the worst kept secret that, he's his son. And the following chase with those, fire ants.
this is where it becomes, it was evident up to this point, but they really start to lean heavily into the whole thematic thing where, at the first trilogy, it was, the 1930s. So they were, emulating the adventure serials of that time. So here we are in the 1950s. And as Spielberg and Lucas said, like we're leaning into the B movie, atomic age, sci-fi, Red Scare era. So here we've got Indiana Jones strapped to a chair with some weird electronic headband, trying to psychically communicate with this skull. And it's like, all right, this is what we're doing. So, and there's Kate Blanchett just picking the scenery out of her teeth with her Russian, her dubious Russian accent that goes in and out. But it was great to, see Karen Allen again, who, looks fantastic after all this time. Yeah, there's the reveal that didn't surprise anyone. And yeah, jump ahead. We've got our creepy crawly for this movie. We went from snakes to bugs to rats, and now we've got fire ants. It's like, all right, what's left? So yeah. That's what they went with. And then, you know, we just kind of get lost literally and figuratively in the jungle, because here we are in the jungle, but it's all this CG madness of just giant saw blades and trucks and boat cars and the freaking monkeys. Oh my God. This is where everybody kind of put the blame on Star Wars prequel era George Lucas, saying like, you know, Steven, we could do this, 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 and this with CG. Well, will it look good? It doesn't matter. That's always been how I interpreted it. But yeah, this is just like an action set piece for the sake of action set piece. Like you said, there's that one reference to Mutt's fencing just so it can pay off in a very overly done sword fight across trucks in the jungle. And I'm like, it's like Chekhov's gun. You know, you mention it. I guess it's going to go off by the end of this show. So why else would you mention his fencing school? But yeah, then we evade the bad guys, and it's a little more of an Indiana Jones theme now with the riddle and following the trail and all that.
Yeah. There's there are some good parts and there's some bad parts to this whole action sequence. I mean, where he thinks he's Tarzan all of a sudden, that lost me. But I thought the fire ants were kind of cool. Yeah. You know, the whole sequence with the amphibious car was cool. So Scott, what were your thoughts on this whole sequence of events after we meet John Hurt as Oxley? We have the whatever that head thing was to be able to understand him, and then the reveal of the son, and then the whole sequence that comes after.
Yeah, like we finally see John Hurt, who was in the movie, who we saw in the credits, and it's like, oh wow, he's playing a crazy person, and you can tell he's having a good time playing this person. It just shows off his face, on his face. You see the return of Miriam, and Indy's like, oh, what, this is your mom? And with the whole Mac double agent, triple agent thing, that is stupid and I think unwarranted. I mean, it just does pay off something where Indy says he's gonna break Mac's nose, and then he does, which I thought was pretty funny. The ants part where they eat the Russians alive, that was a cool scene. Also pretty terrifying because the ants then pick up one of the Russians and take them into the hole to kill him. But and then I remember hating the rope scene at first with him being Tarzan. But as was said earlier, they were making this like a 50s pulp B movie, so I'm perfectly okay with it. It's just one of those things where when I go to watch a movie, I know I have to suspend disbelief, because right after the scene with the vines, Miriam runs the car and they land on the tree and then drive off the tree into the water, and then they survive three drops of a waterfall. So, I mean, yeah, we had to suspend disbelief. And then, of course, surprise, surprise, Max dropping trackers. So, that asshole's going to turn back. So.
Yeah. Eric, what are your thoughts at this part of the movie?
Here's where the movie really starts to lose me. The sequence starts out fine, the chase sequence with the Jeeps. Even something like Mutt, like having to stand his feet like on both Jeeps as they're next to each other, trying not to get split in half. Until he gets taken off into the vines, and it just loses me, the whole swinging away with all the monkeys. That's bad. Using the monkeys to attack the Russians is okay. And then there's a bit where Indy and his Jeep crash, and the Russian's Jeep crashes right behind him, and they duck down and they drive over their Jeep. Onto the anthill. I'm like, somebody's got to be dead. Like, that's just way too much. The fire ants themselves, that's cool. That's interesting. Using the skull to protect themselves. It's nice seeing John Hurt at this point. Like, he's just playing crazy. This is a very well-cast movie, I should say. If nothing else, I like Cate Blanchett. and her Wuxian accent. But the three waterfalls is where I really lose it. Like, one is fine, I guess. I mean, Harrison Ford, like, went over a waterfall and fugitive and survived, and I didn't really mind it. It's a great sequence, but, like, three in a row, and it's CG's really looking fake, and it's just not holding up well at this point. Yeah, that's where I'm really, like, getting a little impatient.
Yeah. There's a few things. There's a couple of good lines. You know, you're a teacher part-time where, Mutt kind of sees what's going on. And, the fact that, Indiana always loved Marion over all the years. You know, they had, this blonde, that blonde, whoever comes through. But Marion was really the one for him. So then Jones's team evades the city's guardians and gains access to the temple, finds it filled with artifacts from many ancient civilizations, identifying the aliens as archaeologists studying the different cultures of Earth. They find and enter a chamber containing 13 crystal skeletons, the 10th missing its skull. Spocko arrives and presents the skull to its skeleton, whereupon the skeletons telepathically offer a reward in ancient Mayan through Oxley. Spocko immediately demands to know everything, and the aliens, actually extra-dimensional beings, begin reanimating and transfer their knowledge to her mind. A portal to their dimension is activated. The other remaining Russians are drawn into it as Jones, Marion, Mutt, and Oxley, who's regained his sanity, escape. The 13 begin to fuse into one. And in the process of receiving the overwhelming knowledge, Spocko is disintegrated and sucked into the portal. Mac is sucked in too when he tries to collect some of the ancient artifacts, similar to how Elsa's greed got to her. Jones tries to help him, but Mac willingly lets go. Jones's team escapes and watches the city crumble, revealing a flying saucer rising from the ground and vanishing into the space between spaces, while the hollow in the valley floor left by its departure is flooded by the wars of the Amazon. So, Scott, what did you think of this whole, when we get the payoff of the crystal skulls and the, knowledge, the thirst for knowledge, which kind of, seems like how the Riddler got his demise, how, other villains have met their demise in other movies. What did you think of this? And you reveal that it was like a crashed UFOs hiding spot for the most part.
This is just when it leans into like the 50s sci-fi, which, I didn't really have a problem with. I mean, we had seen The Voice of God destroy Nazis in movie one. So, and a guy rip out someone's heart. So it's like, I don't really have to, bend my brain to believe this. I guess you can't really do man on woman violence, but I wish there was a different way that Kate Blanchett's character be taken out, even if it's Miriam taking her out, because she really deserved it. She set all this in motion, and she was, her and Mac were taken out like Elsie was, because they wanted too much. I did like that you find out that the aliens were collectors too, because there's all types of different artifacts in the room where Mac is eventually killed in. So that was interesting. But I did like how, there's no, the aliens disappear, and then when they leave, they trip like the water for the mountain, and it washes away all of existence. And Oxley even says, like a broom sweeping away its the footsteps. So I thought that was a good line, but I think what hurt a lot of people is with this being an Indiana Jones movie, they just wanted more. And they wanted more Indiana Jones, but, with it being like an alien 50s movie, that's not what it's going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Eric, what do you think of the end of this movie? Actually, the end of the actions part of the movie.
I'm not quite certain. Why is it? Trying to figure out, so Ox takes the head, and it drives him crazy, and he knows he should put it back. Why is it putting it back reanimates all the skeletons at once? Like, was it? I don't quite understand that part. I think certainly Kate Blanchett gets taken out by her own hubris. She wants to know everything. If she had just asked for simple questions like, what are you? Perhaps they wouldn't overload her mind, and she wouldn't have fire spewed out of her eyes. I kind of like that. So yeah, they're the aliens or interdimensional beings, like, is something, you know, like, yeah, it's just, it's, I'm not really digging the film too much at this point. Like, Mac willingly, like, let's go. What was he think he's going to survive that? I don't think anyone's going to survive going into that portal. I would just assume not. Yeah. It's just kind of flat for me at this point. Like, it's not, yeah, it's not so much like anything like this point or Mutt or anything like that, or like, it's just the whole thing in general. I think there's going to be a better take on the adding aliens to this franchise.
Yeah. Tech, do you agree? Do you think that, you know, again, what are your thoughts on this ending with Smoko, with Spocko and all that stuff, but the whole, you know, really what left a bad taste in people's mouths was the whole introduction of the aliens. I think that's kind of what, you know, people could buy the God and all that stuff in the first movie, but, you know, once you bring in aliens, which is not really what we want in an Indiana Jones movie, do you think that's kind of where the people had the brushback from people?
I absolutely agree. You've presented us with three stories about, you know, essentially religious artifacts, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, the Sankara Stones, and the Holy Grail, you know, all stuff that has basis in myth, you know, across, you know, multiple cultures and religions and all this. And now you present us with, you know, oh, we're dealing with aliens. And even early on, I think it was, I have this in my head reading it somewhere that when Lucas came up with the idea of like aliens, people were like, dude, come on, aliens, you know, space aliens aren't really what Indiana Jones is about. He's like, all right, fine, they won't be space aliens, they'll be interdimensional aliens. I'm like, George, that doesn't help. You know, like, you know, call a spade, you know, it just added even weirder dialogue when he's just like, you know, oh, the space between spaces, like, what the hell does that mean? You know, so it's, you know, this last act, you know, they tease us into trying to remind us that this may actually be an Indiana Jones movie, because there we are running around like ruins and, you know, things are, you know, moving around like traps and, you know, openings and all kinds of stuff. Spectacular set design, I'll give him that. And then, you know, here we are in this final, you know, round room with these skeletons. And it's just like, all right, here we go. And then, yeah, I mean, I don't want to repeat anything that was said by Scott and Eric, but yeah, it's just a bizarre sequence with, you know, these skeletons that aren't quite dead and this portal to another dimension and, you know, psychic powers and knowledge and all this. It's just, it's just like, can we just get to the end here at this point? Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, it's a spectacular shot of them on the mountain looking at, you know, this flying saucer and how it kind of disappears amongst the rubble and all that. And but, you know, it kind of leaves a weird taste in your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the following year, Jones is reinstated at Marshall College and made an associate dean. He and Marion get married. A gust of wind suddenly opens the chapel doors, blowing Indy's brown fedora off the coat rack and depositing it at Mutt's feet. Mutt picks it up and is about to put it on his head before Jones snatches it from his hands and puts it on with a grin as the wedding party leaves the chapel. So, Eric, what do you think of this little, you know, the tease that we all saw was coming, that, you know, had they continued on, it would have been, you know, Mutt or Henry III continuing as in the swashbuckling adventures of the Indiana Jones.
No, I was just like, yeah, I'm fine. Let's put this to bed. Like, we had three really good movies, various degrees. Like, I just feel like it's just too much. Like, unless you're just going to go into whole, like, reboot territory, which is sort of the thing you've heard about the last couple of years. Like, Chris Pratt's name is bandying around. And I assume it's like, he's not going to replace Mutt. He's just probably going to recast as Indy. Sort of do like a James Bond thing. So, yeah. So, no, I'm fine with this ending. Like, Indy and Marion are finally married and, like, go off in the sunset. Like, I'm good.
Mm-hmm. So, Tech, when you were watching this, did you think we were going to get another installment with Shia as the lead?
Well, there's two things about this scene that have always stayed with me. One is you've ended this movie, and at the time, maybe this series, with a wedding, you know, the wedding of Indiana Jones. And you do not include people from his past. Like, why isn't Sala at this wedding? Why isn't Short Round at this wedding? Willie, that may have been a little awkward. So it's just kind of odd. Like, I feel like they missed the mark on that. They just kind of wanted to do this, but didn't really think it through. The other thing is when the hat blows down in front of Shia there, I remember in the theater, he's bending down to pick it up. I am verbally going, "Don't you dare, don't you dare, don't you dare." I'm saying this out loud in the theater, and then he goes to put it on. I'm like, no, no, no. And then Harrison takes it. I'm like, oh, thank God. Because the last thing I wanted was a fifth Indiana Jones movie with Shia LaBeouf as the main character. I pass. Hard pass.
Yeah. Scott, what did you think of the ending? Did you think we were going to see another Indy with Shia in the lead?
Actually, I did. As we discussed earlier, like, Shia was on top of the world at this point, and I could very easily see, like, a fifth one starting, and, you know, Indy is either killed off or incapacitated, and Shia takes over for that. I'm glad that's not where they went, because I think it would just be a different type of series if they had someone else that's not Indiana Jones and not Harrison Ford in that. And, you know, spoiler alert with announced, which it was already known to be in pre-production, but Disney announced that in 2022 there's going to be a fifth Indiana Jones movie with Harrison Ford returning for the last time. So I don't think with Shia's current issues that he'll be returning. They'll probably recast it or just let it be and him not be in it. But I think it will be interesting to see, you know, Harrison Ford being, you know, almost 80 years old doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you bring up Indy 5, which is where we're going to end our Indy talk. So they're supposed to be starting shooting in the fall. James Mangold is on board to helm, and they said this is going to conclude Indy's story. So, Tech, what do you think? Do you have any idea, or have you heard anything about the plot, what it could surround? Are they going to be very smart and steer clear of what we saw in Crystal Skull and get back to Indy's roots? And will basically Indy maybe die, or we maybe get a flash forward to his death or something? Oh. Maybe that's how they conclude it.
Oh, God, I hope not. I mean, if you consider the TV series to be canon, which they kind of do. They kind of make it canon in this movie because earlier in the film, he makes reference to him riding with. Oh, my God. His name just flew out of my head.
Pancho Villa.
Thank you. Pancho Villa. Yeah, which was an episode of the series. So everybody was like, oh, that's the show is canon. So if you take that as truth, we see an Indiana Jones who's like 90 years old, you know, doing these wraparounds. So I hope to God they don't kill the character off. I have no idea what this fifth movie could be about. There's the possibility that they may kind of go back to the well and maybe kind of, well, I hope they don't retread both the Raiders and Last Crusade kind of stuff. One might think it's the safe bet, but I was a little disheartened when I learned that Spielberg wasn't going to come back to do it. Nothing against James Mangold. I've enjoyed the films I've seen that he's done. But it really just comes down to the writing. You know, if you come up with another story that's a little bizarre like this one with, you know, introducing a slew of new characters, you know, everybody in this movie is great. You've got an embarrassment of riches in terms of the talent, Jim Broadbent and Cate Blanchett and all them, you know, in addition to our main characters, it comes down to the story. You know, give us a good story. Don't try something so different just because you think it's thematically appropriate. So I really don't know the slightest thing to expect. I mean, I had theories about what Crystal Skull was going to be, and they were all dead wrong. So I wouldn't even begin to speculate.
All right, Scott, what do you think we could see in Indy 5?
I think that maybe instead of Shia, I think we might get Tom Holland as his son.
Hmm.
Which I would enjoy personally.
I don't know, because isn't he supposed to be
I know he's
Nathan Drake.
Uncharted. Yeah, he's in the Uncharted. But I know that's like the video game version of Indiana Jones. Yeah. But
it would make my daughter happy. She has a big crush on Tom Holland.
but I'm interested in it. I hope they don't kill off Indy. That's my fear, because I think he should be one of those characters that, you know, never dies in the fans' eyes. So I think they should just, you know, have him basically with the third movie right out into the sunset. And if they want to do a spinoff, if they reintroduce the character of Mutt, they can just have it be named something else, but Indiana Jones, you know, be there forever. And I will say, whenever it comes out in 2022, whatever the theater situation is, or if I have to stream it, I will be streaming it the first night it comes out or going to see it in theaters, because that's, I'm just that much of a fan.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Eric, what do you think of we're going to get in Indy 5?
I couldn't even begin to imagine. I would assume the story is going to take place now in the 60s. I wouldn't imagine it trying to fit the 70s at all. It'd be pretty weird. I don't know what else he could do. Like, I assume the story will go back to, like, more religious artifacts, like the first three. I don't know. I'm not really optimistic. I just know Harrison Ford's back, and pretty much nobody else. Obviously, Lucas is not, because he's not involved in Lucasfilm. Sold it. Yeah. So, I don't know. We'll just see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I assume we may see maybe we'll see Marion. I don't know. I mean, Salah, I mean, John Rhys Davies still alive, but they've, you know, killed off all the other characters that we know of. I mean, Oxley's got to be, I mean, John Hurt passed away as well. So, yeah, so there's not much to bring back. I mean, I would like to see Short Round come back to the franchise at some point. So that's going to bring an end to our discussion of the Indiana Jones franchise and this episode of Blockbuster Rewind. But we have, you know, monthly next episode. And Scott, you are at the podium. What is our next episode and who is our guest going to be?
So the next episode is going to be the Shrek series. And our co-host will be Logan Crossland, who's the host of the TNA Impact show for PTB and Wrestling Feed. You've heard him on a bunch of podcasts. Me and him did a podcast live watch of Home Alone, which was great. I hope you guys will listen to it. But yeah, we'll be doing the Shrek films.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Logan is a fun guest. Appropriate that we have one of the youngest members of Place to Be Nation doing our first animated film. So look for that coming out after the new year. But also, before we go, though, let's kind of go around the room and say what else people can be expecting from us. So let's start with our guest, Tech. Do you have a Twitter handle, any kind of social media like people to follow, and any possible upcoming pods you may be on?
Yes, absolutely. If you're so inclined, you can follow me on Twitter at Hal Dameron, HALDAMERON, named for my two favorite fictional pilots. Or on Instagram at Technicolor, TNIKOLOR. You can hear me right now alongside Scott Criscolo on Pop Goes the Classics. We talk about the James Bond films by actor, and we also cover the 10 films in the Star Trek film series upcoming. Scott and I will be doing the three J.J. Abrams directed/produced Star Trek films.
All right, cool. Eric, what else? What do you have going on? You have any social medias, podcasts to direct people to?
Yeah, well, I'm on Twitter at Eric Eels One, ericeells1. And I have no other podcasts at the moment because I am very, very busy at work. But I certainly make time for Blockbuster Rewind every time.
Mm-hmm. So, we appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And all right, and Scott, what else you got coming up that people can be directed to?
By the time you're hearing this, you'll have heard the Pop Goes to the Couch series that I do with Mr. Andy Atherton, Sean Kidd, and a slew of guest hosts that we've had. Tim Capel's one of them. We've been discussed the season finale,
and this new slate of Mandalorian TV shows. I did a live watch of The Rocky for Sousa's podcast, and a laugh in theater with for the Home Alone for the Christmas. To get everyone in the Christmas spirit, I can be reached on Twitter at Scott_Shiflett.
All right, very good. As for me, I mentioned a lot of the shows at the break during the live read, and so we have new episodes of Laughing Theater come out about twice a month. The newest episode of Year in Pop will be coming back right probably not long after you hear this. That is myself, Scott Criscolo, J.R. Senior D'Amato, and Dr. G. George Ribellino will be up to the year 1987. On the wrestling feed, check out the latest Wrestling Great Debate. That should be out right after the new year. And at the end of January, you will hear our friend Tim Capel join me on the latest episode of Evolution, where we broke down the career of Diamond Dallas Page. I will also be on the Place to Be podcast dropping at the end of December, probably right after Christmas. I think the Monday after Christmas, I'm going to be the guest for SummerSlam 1991. It was my first pay-per-view event I ever attended for wrestling live. So the gentlemen, the PICs, were kind enough to have me on as a guest. So I'm looking forward to returning to that show once again.
Very cool.
Yes, thank you. And don't forget all the other great shows, Making Mount Rushmore twice a month, and Pop Goes the Classics, all my other shows. Don't forget, check out everything going on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Network. New shows every day, pretty much. North-South Connection as well. And the Jenny Position, check out the website. Join the Place to Be Facebook group and participate, get in the conversation. And be on the lookout for PTV and Trivia Night. That should be coming soon, starting in January, with my co-host, Jordan Duncan. We're still looking to round out our crew on that show. But that will be a fun trivia game show pod that you will hear bi-weekly. It'll be every other Friday. Should be releasing on this very feed. So I want to say thank you to our guest, Tech. Tech, thank you very much for dropping by and dropping all that Indiana Jones knowledge.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, and thanks for putting up with my minutia.
Yes, yes. Oh, no, that's what we love here on Blockbuster Rewind. We love to have super fans come in and talk about things that they love. Scott and Eric, thank you. It's a pleasure as always.
Of course.
All right. And for those of you out there listening, thank you. Once again, thank you for listening to Blockbuster Rewind, and we'll see you next month when we break down the Shrek franchise. Take care, everybody.